right, all right, all right. Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here till 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude. It's Wild Card Wednesday. Yeah, man, Wild Card Wednesday. Get your requests in now. That's any artist, any song, anything. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And coming up in just a couple of minutes, Lindsey Cochran and Greg Woods from Great Moments in Vinyl are going to join us to talk about their gig this Saturday, where they're going to pay tribute to Elton John with Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. And then after the 1:30 news, a really great guest, Melanie Lentz, is going to join us. At 22 years old, she became one of the youngest female Secret Service agents around, and has talked about the experience, and it's really a fascinating story, and we're going to have her here as well. We're going to talk about movies that the Academy Awards completely ignored, great ones, biggest box office hits, and the quiz that we didn't do yesterday morning, where Dan is going to quiz me on brand names. We'll do that a little bit later. And our phone lines are 312-981-7200 for talk and text and for Wildcard Wednesday requests. My great producer is Dan Shagrew. Hello, Dan.
Howdy, Nick.
How are you?
Good, man. How about yourself?
Good. Had a great turnout for Scrooged, both at the theater and at the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant.
Awesome.
An unqualified success. And the movie was hilarious, and we all had a great time, so it was really a lot of fun. But yeah, so doing good. Ready to produce. In there till 5.
Indeed.
In the newsroom is Vic Vaughn. Hello, Vic.
Good morning, sir.
How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Good, 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 good. Yeah, so Vic's in the newsroom. He'll be there till 5, and we have our phone lines, and you can follow us on Twitter, at Nick D Show. The best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. And we're here until 5 a.m., and we would love to hear from you at some point and get your wildcard requests in right now. So there you go. All right, we are going to take a break, and then Lindsey Cochran and Greg Woods from Great Moments in Vinyl are going to tell us all about their Elton John tribute, where they will play Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, and that's this Saturday night. All right, okay, let's break and come back with those guys. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, and we are here until 5 a.m. It's Wild Card Wednesday. Get your requests in. You're being Wild Card Wednesday. And that is any artist, any song, anything. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for that. Coming up, we are going to be speaking with Melanie Lentz, who at 22 years old became one of the youngest female Secret Service agents, and we're going to talk about her experience doing that. And you know, since everybody has been talking about President H.W. Bush, it's we want to get some perspective from her point of view. It's a fascinating story. She's been on the show before, and she's terrific. And we'll get to her after the 1:30 news. So there you go. What you just heard was Great Moments in Vinyl, and they're going to be performing. That's rehearsal audio from Great Moments in Vinyl, and they're performing Harmony there, and they're going to be paying tribute to Elton John this Saturday, December 8th, at Gallery 1070's Auxiliary Space, which is at 1101 West Granville in Chicago. Lindsey Cochran is the guy who puts this together, and we have them on every time to talk about it. What he does is he gathers a bunch of great musicians. They pay tribute to an artist, and that's what they're doing on this Saturday. And we've got Greg Woods with us, too, from Great Moments in Vinyl. He's a musician. We're going to get to him in a minute, but let's welcome Lindsey first to the show. Lindsey, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Yes, absolutely. I'm very excited about this one. Tell everybody about Great Moments in Vinyl.
The best way to describe what we do is that we're a collection of music fans, pure and simple. You know that feeling you get when you hear a song that resonates with you, you just make you want to get up and dance or punch the air or whatever. You just want to share that excitement with somebody. So that's us. But instead of making mixtapes for our friends or inviting people over for a listening party, we put together a band and play the albums we love live. And in this case, it's the double record set, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Right. Goodbye, Yellow Brick Road. And there's also stories in between. You do some research and you talk about some of the influences and you tell really terrific stories in between the songs, and it makes it a different kind of experience.
Absolutely. And with a guy like Elton John, there are no shortage of stories. I mean, between him and Bernie Taupin and the band and just all the different things he's gotten into and the influences. For example, this album, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, it seems to me, if I recall, they put the album together, believe it or not, in about 18 days.
Insane.
You know, artists go into the studio now, it might take 2 years to put together an album. Elton had a contract back then where he had to put out 2 albums a year. And so he was just pumping through the material, and the guys, they were just on form. They were on fire. They knew what they were doing. They knew how to do this music. And a lot of times, Elton would go in the studio and record his part, and then he'd go off shopping in Paris or someplace like that, and the rest of the band would lay down the harmonies and figure out how the rest of the song went.
Yeah. It's crazy that it was that short period of time to put this record together, which has gone on to become, you know, a major classic.
Oh, my God. Here's a story for you. How universal is Goodbye Yellow Brick Road? I was telling Greg Woods, the fellow who's going to be, we'll be talking to in a moment, but he's the lead singer and main pianist for this show. I was saying to Greg, I can remember being at a huge party back in high school, and they were playing this album. And Greg, who's at least 30 years younger than I am, said, I can remember being at a party back in high school, and they were playing this album.
Yeah. This was back at I think, the height of... Of Elton John's talent, that
no question.
That
I mean, all the things had come together for him in his career, and the drugs had not kicked in yet. I mean, there's a great story about how he basically had not discovered drugs yet. You know, maybe they were doing a little drinking, but all the cocaine and all the other stuff that led to his having to go to rehab, and that came with the next album, Caribou and Rock of the Westies. But on Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, it was just adrenaline and momentum, I think he said. You know, they were on a roll. They'd come off of Don't Shoot Me, I'm Only the Piano Player with Crocodile Rock and Daniel as huge hits, and that came off of Honky Chateau with the title track and Rocket Man. So when they went into the studio, they were just going to do a single record, but there was just so much material that got generated. Out came Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Yeah, and everybody's happy for it. So you guys are going to be at the Gallery 1070's auxiliary space on Granville, and you guys played this just this past summer, right at the Edgewater Arts Festival.
Absolutely, the folks who were doing the promotion of that event also had us in for an after party at Gallery 1070. It's the art gallery there at Granville, and I forget the cross street, but it's a couple of streets west of Sheridan Road. And so kitty corner to that is a former little storefront supermarket, and they have access to that space, and they've cleaned it up. They've put in some nice lights, and there's going to be chairs there and a bar for beer, wine, and soft drinks, and that's all part of the ticket price.
All right, sounds great. Now, one of the musicians that you have in this incarnation of Great Moments in Vinyl is Greg Woods. Greg's never been on the show before. This is the first time, so let's welcome Greg to the show. Greg, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, 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 good. Now, you're a native of Chicago, right? You're from Chicagoland?
I grew up in Naperville, yeah.
Yeah, all right, cool. And when did you get into music, Greg?
I started very young. I was like 4 years old when I picked up the piano, but I come from a very musical family, so it was sort of obvious.
Oh, so that's where it all started. Yeah.
Yeah, my grandpa's a piano player, still to this day at 93, sort of plays circles around me.
Wow, that's amazing. Oh, yeah. That's amazing. So did you actually take lessons, or was it just part of the family thing?
Well, it's kind of a fun story, actually. My brother, you know, we were required to take piano lessons because my grandpa and all of that. But they had my older brother, who was 7, in taking piano lessons. And I would sit in the back corner of the room and watch him practice with the obligatory 30 minutes with my dad. And then as soon as he was done, he'd run outside, you know, enjoy being a child, and I would subsequently run over to the piano and sort of practice what he was supposed to be practicing. So I got into lessons when I was like 4, but then they got kind of boring to me pretty quick. So I picked up a little cover band in junior high and quit piano lessons. You know.
Yeah. All right. And is keyboards and piano that your main go-to instrument?
Well, I got my degree in voice at Millikan University, so I like to think that I'm cross-disciplined between the two of them and that songwriting is actually my strong suit.
Okay, all right. Well, listen, let me ask you about your first memories of Elton John and maybe in particular this record.
Yeah, sure. Elton is big for me. You know, when I quit piano lessons, I ended up just learning tunes to play with my band, or learning tunes that I liked, of course, as any young musician would. And as a piano player, not exactly pursuing classical music or jazz, Elton John was pretty obvious to me. So I picked up an Elton John anthology book when I was just sort of tearing through sheet music and learning how to read and learning how to interpret ink on page. And this record became very, very, very apparent because it was one of those that, you know, you'd heard half the tunes in it in a big way. You'd heard them everywhere in shops and at restaurants and all of that. But then you find the other tunes in it and realize that they're some of the real gems of his catalog and that these B cuts are much lesser known, but he wrote so well. They wrote so well, he and Bernie.
Yeah.
And I think it really blew it open for me, realizing what that record was kind of capable of, having all those hits and having also all of that artistic content, you know.
Mm-hmm. And now what were you listening to a lot? What were some of the other artists that were influential to you that you really loved when you were growing up and soaking it all in as a musician?
Yeah, so my dad's a headbanger, so he loves Led Zeppelin. The first record I ever owned was actually Paranoid by Black Sabbath, because my dad decided to wrap it up poorly, pick it up at Best Buy or something, and throw it at the end of the edge of the tree, and I found it.
You know, that's really,
gift. He's like,
Greg,
yeah, you should have it.
Greg, that's really funny, because the first album that I ever bought with my own allowance and money was Black Sabbath Paranoid.
You know what's even funnier about that?
Mm.
I couldn't have gone further away from that with the first album I bought with my own money. It was Spice World.
That's great. That's great.
All music has merit, right?
Yeah, yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, that's cool. That's really cool. Now, tell me about your own music now. And you have a vinyl release party coming up at the Filament Theater up in Portage Park. That's my neck of the woods. Tell me a little bit about your own music.
Yeah, that's it. That's on January 18th, and my friends at the Filament are wonderful. I company for some of their theater stuff, and they do really, really cool stuff for children's theater. It's really innovative, and I'm really proud of them. But we're excited to do that show. I just got off a tour promoting my record that I actually dropped about a year ago, but we're promoting the vinyl release, and we'll be touring a lot next year. It's a record called Hello, Goodbye, and Later On. I wrote all the music on it. I did two EPs, one in Chicago and one in Nashville, and I sort of wrote them with the intention to sound like the towns to some degree. And I had a really great opportunity to work with some close friends down in Nashville, my friend Mitch Crane at Pennsylvania Studios, and up in Chicago, my friend Noam Wallenberg, Rax Tracks, and Ben Joseph as well. A lot of names, obviously. But I'm really excited about it. I think it sort of spans a lot of different musical styles, which is sort of my styles to just try and lean into what the song wants to be and not focus too hard on what it sounds like.
There you go. So that's Hello, Goodbye, and Later On. If people want to pick it up, the vinyl release party is at the Filament Theater on Milwaukee Avenue in Portage Park, and that's on January 18th. Cool. Hey, Liz.
Yeah, and it's up on all digital platforms. Sorry,
oh, cool. Cool. You guys have a web? What, you have? Do you have a website people can go to?
We're working on the website, but you can find me on all social media platforms at Greg Woods Music, and it's on Spotify, Greg Woods, YouTube, anywhere you get music digitally.
Very cool. Cool. All right, Lindsay, who else is in the band besides Greg for the Great Moments in Vinyl Elton John tribute?
Well, one person you met before is Scott Tipping, who plays all the Davy Johnson guitar. He's going to be rocking it out on Saturday Night's All Right and songs like that. All the Young Girls Love Alice. We got Jonathan Reed on drums. He was a drummer when we did Physical Graffiti, when we did Jimi Hendrix, also when we recently did the David Bowie show, and Fleetwood Mac, he was our drummer. And then Jim Ryan, who played keyboards for us for Pink Floyd and a Rolling Stones set, he's joining us on this one because just one piano is not enough if it's an Elton John song. You got to other textures going on in the background, too. So it's a band of five.
Okay, yeah.
And myself on bass.
And yourself on bass. And that's, well, that sounds great. I'm sure you guys are going to do. So do you have a story that you can tell us that you might tell about the making of this album, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road?
Well, here's a nice little overview. Goodbye Yellow Brick Road seems to me to be a journey. I mean, Elton and Bernie said they didn't really have a concept in mind when they put it together, but it fits together that way. I mean, it starts off with a funeral and the end of a love affair. And then there are songs about fame and what it did to Marilyn and what it was doing for Benny. And then there's songs about people in the margins, prostitutes and the sailors who call on them, a moonshiner in Kentucky, a teenage girl and her lesbian lovers, a British hooligan who loves to have a bit of fun on a Saturday night. But when all the little vignettes come to a close, we take Bernie Taupin's cue and go riding off into the sunset with Roy Rogers. So it starts with a funeral and the end of a love affair, but when we reach the final chords of the album, we discover that Harmony and me, we're pretty good company. Can you ask for anything more than that? And you know, what makes me think of Elton John, as I tell you that, is that after a tumultuous life of his own, filled with ups and downs, where do we find him? Retiring from the road.
Yeah.
Staying at home with his husband to raise his two kids. A happy ending, just like in The Wizard of Oz. So yes, goodbye Yellow Brick Road, because there's no place like home.
There's no
place like home.
Lindsay telling great stories. All right, before we let you go, Greg, you already answered. Whenever I have musicians on the show, I always ask them two questions. One is, what was the first album you ever bought? You already answered that one. Now, what was the first concert you ever saw?
This is a good one. Like I said, my dad's a headbanger, and I already mentioned Led Zeppelin. So first one I ever saw that was memorable, at least, was I actually went to what was then called the Tweeter Center with my dad and my older brother, and we went and saw The Who, and there's a good story behind this, but The Who with opening act Robert Plant and the Honey Drippers.
Oh, wow.
But the best thing about this, the craziest thing about this, is I was forecaddying. I was like 10 years old. I was forecaddying at my dad's golf outing out at White Eagle, and that night, we hear that John Entwistle, the bassist for The Who, had passed away mid-tour. So my dad pulls me and my brother out to the car in the parking lot, leaves all his friends, and tells us, John Entwistle died, you need to register this moment, because my dad's just, like, loves the rock and roll icon.
Right.
And then I found out, like, a week later that this guy named Pino Palladino would be playing the show.
Yes.
And if you run in any musical circles, he's pretty heavy water.
Oh, yeah.
So I got to see Pino play with The Who and Robert Plant and Honey Drippers.
That's a great, that's a great, great first show. Great first show.
Yeah.
All right, you guys, listen, have a great time doing the Elton John tribute. Again, it's this Saturday, December 8th. It's at Gallery 1070's Auxiliary Space at 1101 West Granville in Chicago. Tickets are $25. That includes two drinks from a selection of beer, wine, or non-alcoholic beverages. The 7 o'clock opening act is Acres to Miles, and Great Moments in Vinyl will begin at 8. Greg, nice to meet you. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Right.
Nice to meet you as well.
You too. Lindsay, always a pleasure, my friend.
All the best.
Okay, take care. There you go. Lindsay Cochran and Greg Woods from Great Moments in Vinyl. You can check out greatmomentsinvinyl.com for more information. We have a link on our Facebook page, and check out their Elton John tribute this Saturday at Gallery 1070's Auxiliary Space. All right, we'll take a break. We got the news coming up next on WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here till 5 a.m. All right. I want to welcome back to the show my second guest this morning. My third guest this morning is Melanie Lentz. She, at 22 years old, became one of the youngest female Secret Service agents ever. And you can read about her experience and what she learned from it on her website, which is melanielentz.com, L-E-N-T-Z. It's a really fascinating and interesting story. And she's using these experiences that she's had, these life experiences, to write about other things and provide some advice and life lessons on her webpage. And she's been on the show before, and she's really terrific. So let's welcome Melanie Lentz back to the show. Hi, Melanie.
Hey, how's it going? I'm good. Happy to be back.
All right, happy to have you back. A real fascinating story that we had you on to talk about before. 22 years old, you became the one of the youngest female Secret Service agents. And you these experiences that you've had, Melanie, you talk about the life lessons more than anything else, and maybe people can identify with what you've gone through or learn something from the lessons that you learned, correct?
Right, yeah. I got thrust into a very unique situation at a really young age with very little life experience, and over the course of the next about 10 years, I learned so much about protecting other people, but I didn't realize until I made the difficult decision to leave how many life lessons were tucked in there and nuggets of little things I wish I knew when I was younger. So I've been really, really grateful to have the opportunity to share those stories, whether it's here with you or writing. And I found that, you know, we all kind of struggle with a lot of the same things in our work and personal life balance. So it's been a lot of fun talking about it and sharing, and yeah, I enjoy it.
Yeah, and it's such, you know, just on the simplest of levels, it's such a fascinating and interesting story and kind of an unusual one. And it all started out with your grandpa thought that you should apply to the Secret Service. Is that true?
That's true. You know, growing up, I was a swimmer in college and stuff. So, you know, I always joke that I wasn't super coordinated on land. It wasn't, you know, that job wasn't something I saw myself doing or thought I was capable of. And apparently my grandpa saw something in me that I didn't see at the time. But one of his best buddies had a daughter who was a Secret Service agent. So he would hear about her stories and share them with me and say, you could totally do that. You know, you should apply. So I don't think I would have ever filled out that application and turned it in if it hadn't have been for him suggesting it. But I'm sure glad I did, you know, now looking back. But yeah, it was kind of an interesting start to my career, I guess.
Well, tell me about what it's like, you know, first of all. I mean, there are two things here that's really kind of amazing. You become like a Secret Service agent, or at least you go in for the training first, obviously. But you're really young at this point. You're really young. You're 22 years old, and you're a woman. And what are the majority of Secret Service agents or people who train to be Secret Service agents? The vast majority are male, right?
Right. Yeah. Even today, I think the number is still hovering around the 90% male on the agent front. The Secret Service didn't start hiring female agents until the 70s, so it's still relatively new. But yeah, definitely, I was the ultimate outlier there with my age and my gender. You know, standing in formation for the first time ever. You know, it was reviewed to most of the people in my class because they had a, you know, life experience in military and law enforcement background, and then there was Melanie Lentz, you know, that 22-year-old that still looked 17, standing in the middle, like, what in the world is she doing here,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. What were some of the challenges? I mean, I'm certain it had to be challenging. I mean, you know, like you said, most of the people that were in that room either had, like, military experience or law enforcement experience and more life experience. Was that a huge challenge for you? Was it sometimes, did it suck the life out of you sometimes?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was very challenging. I think what saved me in the end there was that I chose to be trainable. And I didn't go into it with an ego or like I have a chip on my shoulder, like I've just got to prove to everybody I can do this. You know, of course that attitude was there that I need to just do it. But I think where I struggled the most was being very vocal and assertive. You know, that command presence that cops have when they take control of a scene.
Yeah.
That kind of thing was probably something I struggled with because I'd just never done it before. And while a lot of the guys would be able to, you know, relax and have fun after class, I was practicing handcuffing, you know, something that they could do in their sleep, but
yeah.
I couldn't. So
yeah.
I had a lot of things I was just starting from scratch, but as long as I stayed trainable and just soaked up all the knowledge of my peers in my class, I ended up, you know, succeeding, but it was definitely, it felt a little more of an uphill battle for me just because it was all brand new.
And the training itself, what did that consist of? What was, if you can give us just kind of a general look at what training is like to become a Secret Service agent?
Sure. Once you get hired, you start out at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, and that's in Georgia. And that was, when I was there, it was 12 weeks. I'm not sure if it's, you know, give or take. It's probably about the same now.
Yeah.
But you would do, it was kind of like basic training. A lot of federal agencies sent their agents through there. Like my class had half Secret Service, half ICE agents. So it's kind of a basic training. You learn basic federal statutes about working criminal cases because the Secret Service works fraud and counterfeit. And then you would learn, you know, the basics of fighting. You did a lot of shooting, clearing buildings, you know, a lot of the tactical stuff that you could do in any federal agency, just those basics. And then once you pass that, you go on to the Secret Service Academy, which is in Maryland. So that's kind of a follow-up academy, and that was 18 weeks when I was there. And that's where you get into the nitty-gritty Secret Service stuff, as well as the protection aspect of the job. So, you know, we already learned how to clear a building and execute a search warrant, but now we're going to learn how to investigate counterfeit. So we're going to examine the heck out of counterfeit for weeks on end and learn about that. And then we learned how to investigate threats. And you're still doing all that shooting and that fighting, but you add the protection element where certain things are less about self-preservation and you're protecting your protectee in that moment. So you have that transition into the protection side at the Maryland Academy. So once you pass that, then you head over to the field. All new agents start in the field where you work, like I was assigned to the Los Angeles field office. So I worked fraud cases and protected foreign dignitaries and traveled when the president traveled and that sort of thing. So that's kind of how an agent's career will start once you get hired to when you get out of training.
Well, now, when all this was happening, Melanie, what was the attitude of some of the guys that were around? I mean, were any of them supportive? Were they good to you? Were they helpful? And were there also competitive ones and ones who thought that you shouldn't be there because of your gender?
Right. Yeah. Of course, there's always some, and that's probably with any job. But for me, I found that my peers, the other guys in my class, my class had three females. So I was by far the youngest, and then the other two had, one had law enforcement and one had military and law enforcement. So they had kind of some stacked experience.
Yeah.
So I was definitely that outlier. I felt like I was athletic, I was young, so I think that was a perk for me, is that I was able to keep up physically with a lot of them. But I found that it was more the older instructors, the, you know, kind of that old good old boys club that were the most hesitant about me being there. And so, you know, me being the stubborn turd that I am, I just made it my lot in life to win them over. And I was like, you know, you're going to have to, I'm not quitting, so you're going to have to send me home if you don't want me here, because I'm going to be given 110% whether you like me or not. So, like I said, that attitude kind of worked well for me. It's just, I just wasn't giving up. But I think I felt my age probably more than my gender, but the combination of the two was more, I sensed the hesitancy with the older instructors.
Yeah, that makes sense. That totally makes sense. You know, let me ask you this. In the real world, you had, you know, peers who were about your age in their 20s and stuff like that. Were they supportive? Did they think you were nuts? What was the feeling there with your friends?
My friends thought it was super cool, but I think that they watched a lot of over-dramatized TV where they thought I was going to be rappelling out of a helicopter and saving the president with my pinky toe, you know. Like, I think they thought it was more high speed when I realized when I got out of training, I was standing in a hotel stairwell while, you know, somebody, a political official or foreign head of state was sleeping in the room, you know, at the end of the stairwell. So, everybody was supportive. You kind of find, because for me, it's after college, right after college, so kind of the natural progression is, you know, sometimes you grow apart from friends and some you have for life, and so I was kind of experiencing all that, go off into the real world at 22 right out of college. So for the most part, friends were supportive, but I think over time, as I was gone a lot, traveling, you know, I stopped being able to attend all those fun, friendly things. So I think there was some frustration as I first started with friends, just, you know, she's not available anymore. But for the most part, everybody thought I was the cool kid, but little did they know.
That's great. Melanie, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right. Melanie Lentz is with us. Such a great story. MelanieLentz.com to read all the insight and all the stuff that she's been writing about. Her last name is L-E-N-T-Z, MelanieLentz.com. And we've got much more to talk about, including the fact that she was assigned to former First Lady Nancy Reagan's protection detail all the way up until Nancy Reagan's passing. And there's an interesting story, a great story about that that we'll get to and more right here on 720 WGN. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Wildcard Wednesday is commenced, and you can make your requests, and we'll play them a little bit later. It's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We're here until 5 a.m. Coming up is Steve Grzanich at 5 with the opening bell, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN Radio. My guest right now is Melanie Lentz, 22 years old. She became one of the youngest female Secret Service agents ever. She's written about the experience and the life lessons that she got from all this stuff. It's a great and fascinating story. And let's welcome Melanie back. Melanie, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Now, before we get to, because the story about Nancy, the Nancy Reagan and your experiences with her, and in watching the coverage of George Bush's passing and the public appearances and the funerals and everything like that, what is generally like the Secret Service's role in those kind of situations?
Right. Well, once a protectee passes away, whether it's former president or former first lady, in my case, they're protected until they're laid to rest. So, you know, when you become a Secret Service agent, you hope that you're never attending your protectee's funeral.
Right.
But as, you know, protectees age, Nancy Reagan was 94 and former President George Bush was also in his 90s as well. So the transition, you know, as you're protecting somebody who's getting older, you know, the protection changes a little bit. And once they pass away, you're protecting their dignity at that point. You know, they're not, you're not protecting them from, you know, on a stage with a campaign rally. You're just you're there until they're laid to rest. And once they're laid to rest, you step away. For me, I was on former First Lady Nancy Reagan's detail when she passed away. So being one of only two females on her detail, I was in the embalming room with her.
Yeah.
During those preparations. Those things that you don't think about that you might have to do as an agent when you're protecting somebody who's older. So that definitely, I've definitely been thinking about that and really the whole week that after Nancy Reagan passed away, as I'm watching the coverage and everything looks very similar to how it happened
yeah.
with me.
Yeah.
But once Mrs. Reagan was at the funeral home and everything was arranged, they did a private family funeral for her, and they had a bunch of agents as the pallbearers, and I was honored to be one of them.
Yeah.
And I noticed that George Bush's, they did have some agents as the pallbearers for him when they were transporting him to the airport. And so that was kind of cool to see that they were also had that the honor to do that. And I was noticing in the motorcade, I was thinking about Nancy Reagan's motorcade from the funeral home to the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, where she was eventually laid to rest. And I remember that motorcade because I was driving the SUV behind the hearse that day. And I watched that footage of Bush's motorcade, the same similar motorcade, you know, taking the hearse to the airport, or for us, it was up to Simi Valley, California, to their library.
Right.
And just thinking about all those people that lined the streets and the, you know, the sirens, you know, flashing as a sign of respect, and all the overpasses with the signs. And I remember making the comment in that motorcade that day to my shift leader that was in the passenger seat. He said, we said, everyone is just staring at their cell phones. They're all capturing this moment with their cell phones, but they're missing it. They're not even looking.
Yeah,
you know, remember
yeah.
us making that comment, and we said, well, you know, how much of our life are we missing, you know, in real time? I'm not appreciating what I have. And for me, my personal life was in shambles by this point. So it was kind of convicting to sit there and say, like, I haven't appreciated a lot of these special moments. And so that week was just so emotional and so life-changing. It's not a dramatic or exaggerating to say for me, her
right.
Nancy Reagan's passing was very life-changing for me. So, yeah, I've been thinking about all of that this week and, you know, listening to her funeral, the official memorial service and really getting to know this woman I'd been protecting, but I didn't know well because I knew her in a purely professional capacity. So, for me uniquely because I was only with Nancy Reagan a year, so I really learned more about her after her passing and who she was as a person and learned from her after the fact. So it was a weird relationship on my end.
Yeah. I think that's happening to a lot of people now with George Bush passing. I think that's the same case. Yeah, the same thing.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And by the way, I do want to mention a couple more things here. I love the fact that we got to talk about To Live and Die in L.A. the last time you were on.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We watched it at the Academy.
Yeah, I just find that because, you know, a lot of people don't realize that the Secret Service actually covers, you know, fraud and that kind of stuff and counterfeit. And that movie, that's what that movie is all about.
And it's, you know, it is... If I recall correctly, I remember when that movie came out, I think they asked the producers and stuff to kind of make it a little less realistic because him making those plates and the press and stuff, that's all how genuine currency is made. It was a great thing to watch in the training academy.
Absolutely.
I
had the director, William Friedkin, on my show, and he told me stories about where, you know, technical advisors would come in and go, you got to cut some of this stuff out. It's like you're basically teaching people how to make counterfeit money.
Well, that's how our instructors taught us. You're like, okay, watch this little clip, and we're going to talk about it because that's basically what we're going to work on.
I love that. I love that to live and die in LA is part of that part of the training. The other thing I want the other story I want you to tell that you told the last time, people might not have heard it. Your encounter with Obama, which I just think is which is just hilarious. Can you recap that story for us?
Of course. Right. Well, you know, the first question anybody asked me when they found out I was a Secret Service agent was, have you met the president? And up until I met, air quotes, President Obama, I couldn't answer that on it. I said, no, I haven't met him yet. So I believe it was after he was elected, but before he took office. So that transition period.
Got it.
He was doing kind of his thank you speech tour kind of thing that the candidates usually will do. And I was posted up backstage at this event, and on the opposite side of the stage was Joe Clancy, who was Obama's detail leader, and he actually was the director of the Secret Service briefly as well, was on the other side. And Obama gave his speech, and, you know, I could hear on the radio, it's wrapping up, you know, he's going to be leaving. He's supposed to exit, you know, on the same side as Mr. Clancy. And, but instead, I'm sitting here thinking, I'm just waiting for that motorcade to depart so I can go home. You know, like, we're on the downhill slide here, folks.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking the other way, and I hear this voice behind me, and a very recognizable voice, and it said, I'm sorry, did I go the wrong way? And I look back, and, you know, like an idiot with my mouth agape, like, oh, my gosh, it's the President of the United States. And, you know, rather than say, yes, Mr. President, follow me right here this way, Mr. President, you know, blah, 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 I just said, and pointed that way. And he just, like, looked, and then there was Joe Clancy, and he saw him, and, you know, of course, Joe Clancy is running over to us, like, where did he go?
Yeah.
But yeah, so then after that, I could tell everyone, you know what, I've technically met the president, and I, you know, it was a palm to forehead moment, like, you idiot, you know, of course he's always going to remember you, you know, you're never going to be on his detail ever, you know, that kind of attitude. But yeah, that's how I met President Obama.
That's a great story.
Former President Obama now.
It's such a great story. And there's so many other great stories, and you've written about them and your experiences, and you learned a lot from this. Again, you know, you briefly mentioned that you were going through some tough stuff in your personal life when Nancy Reagan passed away, and I you know, when we talked before, the things that you learned from Nancy Reagan and the detail and working helped you get through that time, and you came out on the other side a happier person.
Yeah, that's true. Nancy Reagan's passing prompted me to kind of evaluate my own life, you know, and I wasn't exaggerating when I said it was life-changing, because I listened to her legacy, you know, at people's funerals, you learn about what people remembered, and everybody remembered her huge capacity to love, regardless of any political affiliation, regardless of any of that, that's all anybody ever talked about was how hard she loved. And when I looked at myself back at the time, I was going through divorce, I was depressed, you know, everything was falling apart, I would have said, you know, I'm not the person I want to be. I don't want people to see me like this forever. And I realized, oh, I need to make some changes. And a few months later, I ended up making the very difficult decision to leave the Secret Service. But in the process of doing that, I realized that learning about protection, even if it's just physical protection at such a young age, that gave me so many unique life lessons and how that could be implemented in my own life.
Yeah.
For example, like access control. That's just the fundamental thing of Secret Service protection, you knowing and being effectively knowing when somebody's access needs to be granted to your protectee, denied, revoked, yeah, or limited, that sort of thing. And I had not had enough self-awareness or self-respect to do that in my own life. I let work take over my life when I said, you know, yes to work 100% of the time and no to my spouse and my family more often than not. And when I was falling apart and struggling with the whole divorce and all that stuff, I shut everybody out. I just, you know, access revoked. You know, I'm a tough girl. I'm going to get through this. And I had to learn the hard way about protecting myself effectively, and that's also when you allow positive access and things like that. So the concept of protecting myself has been something that has really helped me as I've moved on, and just being honest with myself. You know, we have to be honest on those radios when we're talking to, you know, if you're in the motorcade talking to your destination agent, you have to be in honest communication with each other. And let people know, like, hey, you've got, you know, a catering truck is doing a 25-point turn right in front of our arrival point. You know, give me a minute, you know, slow roll or whatever.
Yeah.
But if you just say, oh, we're all clear when it's not all clear, that could be disastrous. And that's what I've been doing for a long time, as I was saying. I'm all clear when I wasn't.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I kind of got knocked on my butt, you know, life did, and Nancy Reagan's, you know, passing, while tragic, was definitely a catalyst to big changes in my life and my transition into learning to protect myself better than I had been. And I'm proud to say I'm becoming somebody that I like more than I did before. And
that's right.
And somebody who is, you know, coming out a better person than I was before. And I'm so grateful for that.
It's an inspiring story and really great. And I know that you're inspiring other people as well. People should check out MelanieLentz.com for more information and stuff that you've written about and everything. It's just a pleasure. You know, I love it every time you're on the show. I think you're just great and inspiring and fascinating, and also thank you for giving us your thoughts on you know, watching all the things that are happening with Bush you know, in these past days and coming days.
Lots of memories resurfacing on my end this week from that week. So yeah, no, I love being on your show. You guys are great, and I'm happy to come back anytime.
Okay.
So I appreciate you having me.
Absolutely, our pleasure. Melanie, take care. Okay.
You too. Talk to you soon. See ya.
Okay, there you go. Melanie Lentz. Her story is great. She learned a lot of lessons from it, and she's imparting that wisdom on her website. It's just a fascinating story. She's great. MelanieLentz.com. All right, we'll take a break here. We got the news coming up next on WGN. Wildcard Wednesday kicks off. Yeah, man, Wildcard Wednesday. It's wild. It's a card. And that's any artist, any song, anything. 312-981-7200. Get your requests in now. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. Squat. Requested Montgomery Gentry, Merry Christmas from the Family. That sounds like a relatively amusing tune, doesn't it, Dan?
It does indeed.
Yeah. Hey, welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here. I am your overnight dude here till 5 a.m. We are in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 lovely stories above lovely downtown Chicago. How's everybody doing? We are going to be talking about great movies that were totally snubbed at the Oscars. No nominations, nothing, no love from the Academy Awards. By the way, Dan, did you see who's hosting the Academy Awards?
I did not.
All right, so you know that the ratings were in decline. And Jimmy Kimmel hosted last year, and he did a great job. He did a great job. What they're shooting for here by having this person that I'm going to announce host is they're clearly shooting for ratings, because this person's movies sell tickets. He sells out arenas. Kevin Hart is going to host the Academy Awards.
Interesting.
No. I think that is just a horrible choice to host the Academy Awards. But clearly, they want to go for ratings. They're going for, you know, this guy's popular. He won't be good. He's going to be terrible. He's going to be terrible at hosting the Academy Awards. But he's got a big following, especially on the comedy circuit, and his movies, although they don't make as much money as they used to, they're still pretty solid hits. Like Night School made some money, and you know they still he still has a loyal following. The problem is that Kevin Hart's not the right guy, in my opinion, he's not the right guy to host the Academy Awards. And also, the Kevin Hart's fans, I really don't think care about the Academy Awards because they go see Kevin Hart movies. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
You know what I mean? You know, Kevin Hart's fans like Kevin Hart movies. Kevin Hart movies will never, ever in a million years be nominated for an Academy Award. So it's I think it's a terrible decision. But anyway, that's who's hosting. Kevin Hart is hosting. And there have been a lot of snubs over the years of movies that have not been nominated and things that have, you know, that have been ignored completely. And some of them are shocking, in fact. So I want to talk about that. These are the best movies that were totally snubbed by the Oscars and the Academy. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Discuss that kind of stuff, and then we're going to get into the biggest box office hits of all time and your favorite movies that you can see multiple times. So, and again, you know, I want to thank everybody who came out last night to my film club screening of Scrooged with Bill Murray. And it was a really fun night because, you know, we hooked up with Murray Brothers Caddyshack Restaurant, which is right down the street from the AMC Rosemont Theater at the Crown Plaza Hotel. And a really big faction of my film club members came to Murray Brothers Caddyshack Restaurant and had a great time. Well, we started filing in at 6 o'clock, and then people either drove over or walked over to the theater. And we got to the theater and we watched Bill Murray and three of his other brothers in Scrooged, after having some really great food and a great time at Murray's Caddyshack restaurant. I love that place. It's also got a great bar with tons of TVs where you can watch all kinds of sports and stuff there. And there's memorabilia all over the walls and great posters, you know, honoring Bill and his brothers and all the movies that they've been in and that Bill has been in. And there's also, like, obviously a golf motif, and there's quotes from the movie all over the walls, and they've got really cool merchandise that you can buy. So it was a fun night all the way around. And, you know, the GM of the restaurant was very kind and very excited because we had such a good turnout. He said that he wanted to partner up with us again anytime because so many people came out and had such a great time. And they were kind enough to give all of my film club members 15% off all their food, which was really, really, really nice and generous. And then we went over to the theater and we watched Scrooge. Everybody had a great time. We laughed. We had a really nice big crowd, and then we talked about the movie afterwards and told some trivia and some stories, and it was just a good time. And again, you know, you get into the holiday spirit when you see those kind of movies because it's really got like a very sweet sort of holiday spirit ending. It's just a very funny movie with great cameos and a lot of behind the scenes stories to tell. So we had a great time. We did a Q&A and talked about things. So it turned out fantastic, and I just want to thank all the people who came out to the restaurant, to Caddyshack the restaurant, and to see Scrooged last night. It was great. So we've got another, you know, we do this every month, and next month on January 8th, we will be showing Slapshot, which is one of the greatest sports movies of all time, one of the funniest movies ever made, and clearly the best hockey movie that's ever been made. Paul Newman, unbelievably hilarious in it. Strother Martin, the Hanson brothers. Lindsay Krause is in it. It's one of my favorite movies ever. And we screened it about 6 years ago. By the way, last night we celebrated our 7th anniversary of doing the film club. It's been 7 years since we started doing it. We started in December of 2011 with the Ref. That was the very first movie we ever showed, which is my favorite Christmas movie of all time. But anyway, so we had a screening of Slapshot. It was about 6 years ago, and it was in April, and it was during a playoff run for the Hawks, and so there was a Hawks playoff game that night in April, if I'm not mistaken. It was like the first round of the playoffs, I believe, started right then. And also that evening, 7 inches of snow. So we didn't have a big crowd, and it was only on DVD. At that time, we were showing DVDs and stuff. Now, we only show the best. We show the 4K restoration, DCP, digital prints now. We don't show DVDs. We stopped doing that. So we're going to screen it again for anybody who was there like 6 years ago. Thank you, first of all, for weathering through the storm, the 7 inches of snow. But we're going to do it again on January 8th, and this time we'll do it up well. It's one of the funniest movies ever made, and if you like Slapshot, if you've never seen Slapshot, you have to come. So it'll be January 8th at the AMC Rosemont 18. Tickets aren't on sale yet. We just closed up shop on Scrooged, so the tickets are not on sale yet. They'll be on sale in the next few days, and you can reserve your tickets. It's only $10. Parking is free. And you get to see Slapshot, one of the greatest movies of the 70s, one of the funniest movies ever made, the best hockey movie of all time. And for my money, one of the greatest performances that Paul Newman has ever given as Reggie Dunlap. One of my favorite performances ever. And I mean, come on, man. How can you argue against the Hanson brothers? I mean, that's just genius. So that's going to be on the big screen on January 8th. Again, it starts at 8 o'clock. Tickets are $10. Parking is free. And they'll be on sale soon at amctheaters.com. And then in February, we are doing my mom's favorite movie, which is a great movie for Valentine's Day, one of the most underrated and hilarious movies of all time. And we lost Neil Simon a few months back, and this is going to be our tribute to Neil Simon. It's Neil Simon's Barefoot in the Park. We're showing that February 5th with Jane Fonda, Robert Redford, Mildred Natwick. It is it's one of my favorite movies ever. I think one of the funniest movies of all time. I know every line to that movie, and I'm very excited. And my mom is beside herself. It's her favorite movie ever. And if you've never seen it, you really should. And it's a great movie to see for Valentine's Day. It's a great romantic comedy and a really wonderful movie. And I think one of the best things that Neil Simon has ever written. So that's going to be in February. And I'm very excited about that one. Very, very excited. And I hope people can come out. I know a lot of people have not seen that movie. It's not like one of the most incredibly popular Neil Simon movies, but it is indeed a classic. And Robert Redford in that movie is ridiculously funny. It's one of my favorite comedic performances of all time. So that's in February. That'll be February 5th. And then I'll give you a quick rundown of what we're doing after that. In March, we're going to do Mr. Smith Goes to Washington with Jimmy Stewart, one of the greatest movies ever made. And then we're going to double up on Jimmy Stewart the next month in April when we show The Man Who Knew Too Much, the Alfred Hitchcock movie. And then we're going to double up on Alfred Hitchcock because the following month in May, we're going to show North by Northwest with Cary Grant. So we're doing some classics straight in a row. Barefoot in the Park, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, The Man Who Knew Too Much, and North by Northwest. So that's our schedule up through the spring, and then we'll program the summer and the fall a little bit later on. But, you know, and for all the information, we have a Facebook page, and you can like us on Facebook. It's facebook.com, the Nick DiGilio Film Club. And you can leave suggestions there, too, for movies that you would like to see. But so that's what's coming up. So anyway, in January, on January 8th, it's Slapshot on the big screen. And in February, it is Barefoot in the Park, a classic with Jane Fonda and Robert Redford, one of the great Neil Simon comedies of all time. So that I just wanted to shout out some of the stuff that's coming up on our film club, getting ready for 2019, going into our eighth year. So there you go. And again, thank you so much for everybody who came out. It was a great time. Scrooge was a lot of fun to watch. And the restaurant, the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant, I want to thank those guys. The crew and the management at that restaurant for being so kind to my film club members and having great service and really good food and a fun atmosphere. So it was a good night all the way around. So we'll do it again with Slapshot in January. So there you go. Just wanted to shout that out. Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll jump into the best movies that were totally snubbed at the Oscars. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to jump in on this conversation, talk, or text. So there you go. Man, I haven't heard this song in years. Wildcard Wednesday, Paul requesting Foreigner with Fool For You Anyway. I forgot that I liked that song. That's how long it's been since I've heard it. I haven't heard that song in years. I like that song. All right, Wildcard Wednesday. Yeah, man, Wildcard Wednesday. Get your requests in now, 312-981-7200. Any artist, any song, anything, 312-981-7200. Okay, we are talking about movies that got ignored. Most people love these movies and have become, you know, either favorites from people around the world, or they were critical darlings, or they were failures at the beginning, but then have gone on to become really big, and the Academy ignored them completely. So if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. All right. First one they bring up is The Shining. Inexplicably loathed by critics on release, The Shining was nominated for a Razzie Award. Oh, I didn't know that. While being blanked entirely by the Oscars, the movie, which reunited horror power trio Stephen King, Stanley Kubrick, and Jack Nicholson, wasn't critically reassessed until the end of the 80s, but it was too late for any Oscar success. Well, you know, I mean, I mean, I can see it getting some nominations, but, you know, it's a horror movie, and horror movies have historically not done well with the Academy. I got a feeling that A Quiet Place is going to change that this year. I think A Quiet Place is going to be a heavily nominated movie. I would love to see Hereditary get some nominations, especially Toni Collette. But that one's, you know, like, A Quiet Place is scary. It's a really scary movie. But Hereditary is weird and, like, freaky. And, like, the last 15 minutes is like, what the hell is happening? So I think that's going to work against it, even though I think it's a better movie than A Quiet Place. But I think A Quiet Place is going to get, I think A Quiet Place is going to get a lot of nominations this year. I really do. And deservedly so, because it's a terrific movie. And it would be really, really something. If it's, I don't think it's going to happen. If both Bradley Cooper and John Krasinski were nominated for Best Director in the same year, that would be pretty cool. Bradley Cooper is a shoe-in. Let me just say that right now. He's a shoe-in. And that movie, The Star Is Born, is going to have like 8 million nominations. You know, Lady Gaga is going to get nominated. Bradley Cooper is going to get nominated for both actor and director, and songs, because he wrote some of the songs. And I think there's a possibility that two songs from A Star Is Born will get nominated. Which means that personally, Bradley Cooper could get 4 nominations in 1 year. Which is wait a minute. He co-wrote the movie too. He could get 5 nominations for adapted screenplay, directing, actor, and then songs. So,
yeah, I know that when Eric removed the movie for us, he's like, mark the tape, I'm making the prediction, because it would be the first time since Walt Disney that
right. He
received 5 nominations in the same telecast.
Right. Yeah, that's really amazing. I mean, who would have thought this? I mean, Bradley Cooper remake A Star Is Born. You know, when I first heard about it, Bradley Cooper's remaking A Star Is Born, I'm like, well, that's a bad idea. I don't, you know. Bradley Cooper's never directed a movie. He's, you know, clearly become a very good and interesting actor. And he has also clearly worked with a lot of very talented directors. And evidently, he learned a lot from working with those directors, because A Star Is Born's a terrific movie. It's a terrific movie. And it's going to get a lot of love on Oscar night. But horror movies necessarily don't. And yeah, when The Shining came out, you know, now everybody considers The Shining a classic, and this is one of those cases where it was not universally praised when it came out. I don't remember it getting a Razzie Award. I did not know it got nominated for a Razzie. But it's not the classic that it is now. It did not, out of the gate, it just didn't work. And even Stephen King would go on talk shows and bitch about how much he hated it. So when you've got the writer of the book, a beloved book written by an incredibly popular writer who had and still has an insanely loyal fan base, when he's going on TV talking about how bad the movie is, that's not going to help. But you know, you look back and you watch The Shining, and that deserves some recognition. There's no question about it. You know, I don't know about Nicholson. I don't think I'd nominate Nicholson for Best Actor, because he's just, like, being nutcase Nicholson. But Shelley Duvall is amazing in that movie. And it took a lot out of her, too. It was a real horror show to do that movie for her. Like, Kubrick, like, prodded her and, like, really basically almost abused her. And if you watch her in that movie, she seems like she's like genuinely like out of her mind and manic. And she was like, it wasn't a joke. And Kubrick made her do take after take after take after take after take of the most intense and crazy stuff. Like when the crap hits the fan late in the movie and Nicholson's running around like a lunatic, you know, with a hatchet, the level of energy with which Shelley Duvall plays those scenes is in ridiculously high, to the point where you're like, oh my God. And that was what she went through a lot. She's terrific in the movie. And so is the kid who played Danny. His name is Danny. It was Danny Torrance in the movie, and I can't remember the kid's last name, but that's basically the only movie he ever made. He just went underground. I remember about 15 years ago, we wanted to find him. Like, we wanted to have him on the show, you know, and Andy was looking for him. This is like 15, 20 years ago. And Andy was like looking for him. I believe he started teaching or something, and now he's just gone. And I can't remember his name, but it's Danny. So anyway, the kid who played Danny Torrance was really good. But yeah, The Shining, no love from the Academy Awards. And that's the first movie that we're going to be talking about on this group of movies that were ignored completely. Movies that were considered great that were ignored completely by the Academy. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Quick break and then the news. One of my favorites. That's one of my favorite. That's one of my favorite cartoon theme songs of all time. Only took second request, and we got the TV theme already, Dan. Wild Card Wednesday. Yeah, man, Wild Card Wednesday. That's any artist, any song, anything. 301 area code requesting the Super Chicken cartoon theme song. welcome back, everybody. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, high above downtown Chicago on a Wednesday morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for your Wildcard Wednesday request and to talk and text. We're talking about movies that are considered really great that were not loved at all by the Academy, that were ignored by the Oscars. And you look back historically and you go, wait a minute, these are really great movies and maybe they should have gotten some awards love. So let's get back to it and talk about it. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. So next is The Big Lebowski. This stoner comedy classic may have been a little too goofy for the notoriously middlebrow Academy, but the movie is a much loved classic, and even inspired a minor religion, dudism. Yeah. Speaking of dudism, yesterday was Jeff Bridges' birthday. 69 years old, Mr. Bridges. My favorite actor. See, here's the thing about The Big Lebowski. The timing of The Big Lebowski, well, first of all, this is yet another movie that when it came out, nobody liked. And I'm including people who have seen it 9,000 times now. Like, when it came out, I went with a group of friends to see it when it came out, and they all disliked it except me. I was the only one who, on the first go-round with The Big Lebowski, loved it. And it took 2-3 more viewings for my friends to finally get on board and go, yeah, you know what, this is pretty great. And that's pretty much how everybody felt when it came out. And it is weird. It's a goofy, weird movie that is not really kind of an Oscar kind of a movie. And then the timing of the movie also added to it not getting any Academy love. And it's because it was the Coen brothers' follow-up to Fargo, you know, which did so incredibly well. All kinds of nominations for that. And then because it's just such a weird, like, out there stoner detective noir movie, that following Fargo with that is weird. So it was never in the cards for the Big Lebowski. Never in the cards. All right, how about this? Reservoir Dogs. A video store worker called Quentin Tarantino scraped together $1.5 million for his first feature. It was a critical hit and soon became a cult favorite, but the Oscar nominations wouldn't roll in until Tarantino's next movie, Pulp Fiction. That's true. That's true. And it was such a small film that it took a long time. Reservoir Dogs, it was a, you know, obviously very low budget. Nobody knew who the hell Quentin Tarantino was at that time. You know, many of the actors, besides Harvey Keitel, weren't incredibly well-known in it. And Keitel actually helped get it made. Keitel like produced it and got it made for Tarantino. And it did, you know, like as soon as it came out, it became like an underground sensation. And it could have snuck in there for screenplay. I think that would have been, you know, because, you know, when a movie like that comes out, you know, it's like, let's reward it with a screenplay nomination. That's what they usually do. They're going to say, all right, people really, really like this movie. We're not going to give it multiple nominations, certainly not Best Picture, but let's throw, and it won't win, but let's give it a screenplay nomination. And there was a strong case to argue that Reservoir Dogs did that. 2 years later, though, Pulp Fiction came out, and, you know, and every movie that Quentin Tarantino makes now gets multiple nominations and wins and stuff like that. So, every single movie. And he was actually another one of his movies that got ignored. I wonder if Jackie Brown got any nominations, because Jackie Brown is one of those really underappreciated Tarantino movies. All right, how about this one? Mean Streets from 1973. Martin Scorsese's early career account of his experiences growing up in Little Italy. Mean Streets was hailed as one of the most original American movies of all time immediately after its release. The Academy didn't agree, and Scorsese wouldn't actually win an Oscar until The Departed in 2006. Yeah, but, you know, he followed up Mean Streets with Taxi Driver, and Taxi Driver got multiple nominations. So it didn't take long. I think, you know, because Mean Streets was not distributed in the kind of way that Columbia distributed Taxi Driver. Taxi Driver was one of those movies that had, you know, actually had a studio behind it. Mean Streets was this scrappy little indie movie that worked on word of mouth and critical acclaim. I remember, you know, Siskel and Ebert taking special time to talk about Mean Streets, about how great it is, and that it should have been many more people should have seen it. Now, obviously, as years have gone by, Mean Streets is considered a classic and one of Scorsese's best movies, and it is. It's a masterpiece. But it didn't take long for him to get some recognition, because he got, you know, like I said, Taxi Driver got nominated for, like, everything the year it came out, and that was only a couple of years after Mean Streets. So, but yeah, I mean, for his win, For Scorsese to have to wait until 2006 for The Departed to get an Oscar is ridiculous. And also, The Departed's not one of his best movies. It's a good movie. It's a really good movie. But, you know, I could name seven Scorsese movies before that where he should have won. You know what I mean? And it was frustrating every single time, you know. A lot of people thought he was going to get it for Gangs in New York, which is another movie that wouldn't have been one of his best movies to give it to him. I mean, to ignore him, you know, Raging Bull, you know, Taxi Driver, all these, you know, amazing movies that he's good. Goodfellas? I mean, come on, Goodfellas? Kevin Costner beats Martin Scorsese for Best Director that year for Dances with Wolves? Are you serious? I think that's probably one of the biggest, one of the most ridiculous, you know, losses, is that Dances with Wolves wins Best Picture and Kevin Costner wins Best Director over Goodfellas. I mean, I don't know, maybe there was no, maybe you couldn't do it in retrospect in 1990 when the movie came up, but it seemed obvious to me which movie was better. Back when the movies were released, it seemed very obvious to me which movie was better and which movie was going to last longer in the minds of people, and it clearly was Goodfellas. But yeah, Mean Streets, nothing. So, let's see. Here's Rita on WGN. Hi, Rita.
Hi, Nick. How you doing?
All right.
I'm calling because I remember The Color Purple. I read the book first, then I saw the movie. Each time I see it, I cannot believe it didn't win any Oscars. I know it was nominated for quite a few, and I think I remember at the time that there was, like, jealousy, that they thought that might have contributed to, you know, Oscars. But, I mean, oh, Whoopi Goldberg, and then I can't remember the actress's name that played the lady that was the minister's daughter, and then Danny Glover, and the cinematography, and it was so sumptuous. And
yeah.
The characters were so rich.
I've never read the book. I like the movie. I don't love the movie. I like the movie, but it was nominated for 11 Academy Awards and it didn't win any.
Yeah.
Dan, can you look up what won that year? Because that was 1986, if I'm not mistaken. It was 1986, and it wasn't Out of Africa. Out of Africa was 85. One I can't remember what won in 86. So it would be, I think, Dan, it would be the the Oscars that were handed out in 87, because that's usually how they log them. So the ceremony that took place in 87 honored the movies of 86, and I'm pretty sure that Color Purple came out in 86, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, it was nominated for 11 Academy Awards, and you know, the thing is that the jealousy thing, Rita, might be right, because you know, Spielberg, one of them at that time, still and to this day, one of the most commercially successful directors of all time, who'd never really been taken very seriously in the Oscar world. You know, Jaws got nominated for a bunch of Academy Awards. Close Encounters got nominated. But he was more known for doing the big adventure movies and stuff that people didn't take seriously as Oscar, you know, Oscar bait. But, so 86, right?
Well, 85 is listed next to the categories.
Oh, so it was 85. So, yeah, okay, then so out of Africa, then.
Correct.
Okay, so Out of Africa beat it. Yeah, and that was it.
Sure, you know, but the characters were, when I read the book, I got to see the movie, and I didn't see it originally when it came out in the theater, and I just am blown away that it didn't.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people were surprised. A lot of people were surprised, especially Spielberg. I can tell you that. I can tell you that much. So, all right, Rita. Yeah, that's that. But that was a movie that did get a lot of love from the Academy Awards, at least in nominations. It was shut out. People were surprised by the fact that, I mean, you know, a film that gets 11 nominations doesn't even get one, not even in a technical category. But again, if you look at Out of Africa, especially in the mid '80s, that's the kind of movie they like to award, and Out of Africa is a terrific movie. You know, 3 hours long, romantic, historic, lush, beautifully photographed, lots of locations. So, Rita, thanks for the call. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're talking about movies that don't get love from the Academy but are considered really good. Here's one: Groundhog Day. Speaking of Bill Murray, we had some fun with that. We were talking about, with the crowd last night, I was asking people what their favorite Bill Murray movies were, and Groundhog Day popped up a lot. Like, people love that movie, and as well they should. This smart, well-constructed movie is a cornerstone of 1990s comedy, which has endured as well as Bill Murray's career. It was added to the United States National Film Registry as being deemed culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant, but it didn't receive one single Oscar nomination. Well, okay, it's a comedy. Again, and historically, comedies don't fare well. It's kind of sci-fi, you know, or it's kind of fantasy. You know, when you're living the same day over and over and over again, that's got kind of a sci-fi feel to it. And, and at that time, Bill Murray was not considered what he is now. That changed when Rushmore came out. When Rushmore came out, people were like, oh, Bill Murray, he's doing these weird indie movies now, and that's all he does now. I mean, he'll show up in a big movie every once in a while, but like we were talking about this last night at the Scrooge screening, how interesting there it is for the two halves of his career. You know, like the first half where he wasn't really taken very seriously as an actor, everybody loved him in comedies and stuff like that. But then the second, like with the Wes Anderson stuff, is what really sort of, you know, and then he started working with Jim Jarmusch, you know, and Sofia Coppola and all that stuff, and it, you know, went down the path that he's gone down, you know, in a pretty interesting way. But Groundhog Day was before that, unfortunately. And again, this is one that they could have thrown a bone for screenplay. They could have done that, and that's about all it would have gotten. But you know, obviously, in retrospect, you look back at that movie; it's one of the best. It's an American classic. So, all right, let's take a break here on 720 WGN. We are talking about movies that are considered great that got no love from the Oscars. 312-981-7200 if you want to jump in. Well, that's the best part of Baby Driver right there. That's the best scene in Baby Driver. The foot chase that leads into the car chase that leads into the shootout, all edited together with that song, Hocus Pocus by Focus. 708 area code requested that on Wild Card Wednesday. I love that song, and I love that scene. It's Wild Card Wednesday. Yeah, man, Wild Card Wednesday! 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Any artist, any song, anything. Yeah, that's just the great. That's the best. And that's the one time in the movie where Edgar Wright was being all clever. Well, no, it's not the one time, because the whole damn movie is clever. But like in terms with the song selections and how, you know, how the way he'd set up the song selections, the song before that, this song is Hocus Pocus by Focus. And the song right before that, that leads into the foot chase, is by Blur. See what he did there? Song by Blur, followed by Focus. See? Yeah, that's the guy. That's the guy who's responsible for Shaun of the Dead. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Coming up right here is Steve Grzanich at 5 with the opening bell, Steve Cochran at 6, and coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. We are talking about movies that are considered great that didn't get any love from the Academy. And we got some classic ones that we've been talking about, but the situations are a little interesting to talk about when those films were released and how they were initially received. And that's kind of the stories behind a lot of these movies. Now, here's the next one. Now, this one people were genuinely surprised by this, by the lack of nominations for this movie. And it was from last year, and that's Wonder Woman. You know, this was a cultural phenomenon. It was one of the biggest box office hits of last year, if not the biggest. Maybe it was. I think it was the biggest. I think Wonder Woman was the biggest movie of last year. I'm talking 2017, not 2018, even though we're at the end of the year here. But people were really surprised. Like, it, you know, a lot of people thought Patty Jenkins was going to get nominated for director, again, throw the screenplay bone. And the technical stuff, Wonder Woman was a really well put together film in terms of cinematography, score, special effects. You would think it would get some of those. And Gal Gadot's performance, a lot of people really loved and thought maybe she could get nominated. I didn't think so, because last year there's a lot of competition in the Best Actress category. It says, while the Academy is adverse to superhero movies, it seems bizarre that they didn't recognize the cultural significance of Wonder Woman, which, aside from everything else, is the highest-grossing movie ever directed by a female director. The movie itself was thrillingly entertaining, and Gal Gadot's performance as the titular heroine, particularly praised by critics. Now, here's the thing, because the Academy caught hell for that, for giving no Academy Award nominations or anything, no recognition at all to Wonder Woman, which was clearly the movie story of last year, you know, the cultural significance of it, the whole thing, the female empowerment of it, everything. They're going to make up for it big time with Black Panther this year. You know what I mean? They're going to say it's another superhero movie that became a cultural event. And, you know, before Avengers came out, the movie of the year. And it's going to get recognized. There's no way that they are not going to recognize Black Panther in at least one or two major categories, and in some smaller ones. They'll definitely, you know, art direction, special effects, all that stuff. But no, because the Academy caught hell for ignoring Wonder Woman. They really did. And they will really catch hell if they ignore Black Panther. Let me tell you, it's not going to be a pretty sight. So let's see. Here's Dave on WGN. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Nick, I could be totally wrong about this, but I believe that 2001 Space Odyssey was not terribly liked by either the Academy or the public.
Yeah, no, it was, it became, you know, as the years went by, it became a much bigger movie than it was. I think it was nominated. Yeah. I think it was nominated, though. I'm pretty sure it was nominated in some major categories. I think Best Picture it was even nominated for, or at least in some major categories. I also find it very coincidental and odd that a guy named Dave is calling in about 2001.
What? Why is that?
Because the main character in the movie is Dave, and his name is said.
Hal's speaking to him. Okay.
I'm sorry, Dave. I can't do that, Dave. That's what it is.
And that guy, the voice of that guy, the actor,
just died. He just passed away. Yeah. He was like.
But I think that was a year. People liked movies with social themes.
Yeah, 1968 was a big time for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's also a great movie that same year called Medium Cool. Do you know that movie?
Absolutely. Shot here in Chicago. Robert Forrester, Axel Wexler directed it. Yeah.
That's
a great movie.
That's a little-known movie, but that is a great Chicago movie.
It is. Yeah, one of the best movies shot here. No question about it.
Right.
All right, Dave, thanks. Yeah, they shot that. This movie, Medium Cool, Dan, is like a fictional narrative, but it's shot very documentary-like because they shot it during the 68 convention and all the insane stuff that went down, you know, in Grant Park and all in the city, and they captured all that, and then they made a movie around it. It's a terrific movie. I mean, really, really, really good. And it didn't make a ton of money when it came out, but it was, you know, like one of the most political films of that year. But 2001. The thing about 2001 was when that movie came out, it went way over people's heads, and it still does. Like, I don't know what the hell's going on during like a third of that movie. I still try to figure it out, and there are pieces. I think I've got it. You know, I've only seen that movie 900 times over the course of, you know, like 40 years, and I think I got it. But every time I watch it, there's something there where I go, "What is that? What?" But the thing is, because it was a very weird movie, and it was like groundbreaking in terms of special effects, because those kind of special effects we're used to now. Like when Star Wars came out, it was also like, "Ooh, look at that!" But when, you know, but Star Wars came out 9 years after Close Encounters, and if you look at the special effects in Close Encounters, just as good, if not as innovative or better, than what happened in Star Wars. So anyway, but here's the quick story about 2001. This is how 2001 was received in 1968. It was received by hippies. It was totally embraced by pot-smoking hippies. Like, they loved it. And what they would do, and this is absolutely true story, this was a phenomenon that was happening around the country when 2001 was in the theaters for the first time. People who had seen it, like the hippies, would go and see it. Oh, man. Wow, man. Because, I mean, you've seen 2001, right?
Yep.
It's an extraordinarily trippy movie. So what they would do is they'd drop acid. Hippies would go and see the movie. This is a true story. They would drop acid because, I don't know if you remember, the last like 15 minutes of the movie is all that trip that Cure Dulé goes through. It's lights and sound and weird. And it goes on forever. Like, it goes on for like 15 minutes. And then he ends up, you know, like in that room, and he's old, and then he's a star baby and all that stuff. And, it's, you know, and this is the last 15 minutes of the movie. And then all those lights and crazy. People would drop acid. So at a time in the movie so that they knew when it would kick in, and it would kick in right before the trip scene. So they would drop acid and go, "Okay, man, drop it now, and it'll kick in right before the last 15 minutes. And then they would get out of their seats before the last 15 minutes, and they'd lay on the floor in the front of the theater, and they'd watch it. This was a phenomenon that went around. It was around the country. People drop acid, lay on the floor in the front just during the last 15 minutes of that movie. So that's why it wasn't as critically. I mean, the hippies loved it, but everybody else was kind of like, "What the hell's going on?" Then again, now years later, everybody thinks it's a classic, but okay. We'll take a break. The news is coming up after this. Wildcard Wednesday continues. Emo requesting Hard Rock Coco and Joe. That's the theme from Hard Rock Coco and Joe. It's that time of year. Wildcard Wednesday, yeah, man, yeah. 312-981-7200 for any artist, any song, anything. Also, for talk and text, we're talking about movies that are considered great but got no love and no respect from the Academy or the Academy Awards. And it's Nick DiGilio here. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here till 5 a.m. Coming up, we're going to talk about the biggest movies of all time as well. And Dan's going to give me a quiz after the 4:30 news that requires me to think. And if you've ever listened to the show on the Wednesday morning following one of my film club screenings, right around 4 is when I start to lose all kinds of brain function, because I miss my nap and my lack of sleep. And this might be a little even goofier because we got together 2 hours earlier than we normally do last night in order to have some dinner at the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant. So that could be an interesting quiz. Dan, I hope you're ready to be Quizmaster General.
I will be, yes.
Okay. We are talking about movies that got no love from the Academy but are considered great. Next one here on in this article is this is Spinal Tap. Spinal Tap is one of the most irreverent comedies overlooked by the stuffy Academy, who often favor prestige over wit. Shot in just 5 weeks with most of the dialogue improvised, the movie managed to bottle comedy lightning, and the mockumentary remains just as funny today. That one didn't have a chance to get to get any love from the Academy. I mean, look, hey, this is Spinal Tap is a classic. It's one of the greatest comedies ever made, and it is to this day a work of genius that I could watch anytime, anywhere, and still laugh my ass off. But that was not. I mean, you know what? Actually, what you know what? Original songs. That now I'm just thinking because they could have been nominated for throw a bone at them for original song. You know. Because they were all original songs, all the songs they perform in that movie. They should have been nominated. The song that should have been nominated is what's that's really beautiful when he plays the piano. You've seen This is Spinal Tap, right?
Yeah, a long time ago.
When Christopher Guest is at the piano and Rob Reiner, who's playing the filmmaker, is interviewing him, and he plays this really beautiful, lovely melody on the piano, and Rob Reiner goes, "Wow, that's really lovely. What's that called?" And he goes, "Oh, this piece. It's called Lick My Love Pump." That's one of the biggest laughs in the movie. All right, how about this? They're saying the Terminator should have had some love. You know, the thing about the Terminator was it's another one of those movies that kind of came out of nowhere. Like, you know, very low budget, really, really low budget. You know, at that time, Arnold was just Conan. He was Conan the Barbarian, and nobody knew, everybody thought he was an idiot. And Jim Cameron, nobody knew who Jim Cameron was at that time. And so there was no way it was going to get it because it was low budget and the special effects were a little cheesy. It was sci-fi. But, you know, as time went on, Jim Cameron got enough love from the Academy. He's fine. But the Terminator, I saw three movies the same weekend in 1984. The Terminator opened in 1984. And the other two movies, the movies that I put them in order, the movie that I saved for last because I thought it was going to be awesome because I was like, I'm going to save the best one for last. And I went with Scott to see the last one. Like, I went by myself to see the first two, and then I went with Scott Oaken to see the last one, which we were, saving because we were so excited about. Okay, so the three movies that I saw on that day, and I'll tell you the order in which I saw them in. So that's how I prioritized them. And I saved the best for last. The first one I saw was A Nightmare on Elm Street, which I was like, eh. You know, and I think Wes Craven was coming off of a really bad movie at that time. I think maybe Deadly Blessing was the movie he made before that, or maybe Swamp Thing. Like, he made a couple of really bad movies before that. And I was like, oh, that's going to suck. Some low-budget Wes Craven movie. Wes Craven's on a pretty bad roll right now. So I'll go see that one first, get that out of the way. Okay, and then, of course, it rules. And I saw it, and I thought it was unbelievable. So the second one I saw was Terminator, okay? And again, I ran in, Arnold Schwarzenegger, what is this going to suck? Awesome. But the one I saved for last that Scott and I were so excited about, Chuck Norris in Missing in Action. I've never been wronger about the order of movies to see. Yeah. All right. Here's one, though. Duck Soup. The Marx Brothers Duck Soup. One of the greatest comedies of all time. You know, and I did not know that Duck Soup was not loved by the Academy. That's absurd. That's really absurd. The Marx Brothers brand of quick wit, slick physical comedy, and biting political satire means their movies are some of the few from the 30s that still feel fresh today. Nothing from the Academy, but the Academy attempted to rectify their oversight by giving Groucho Marx an honorary award in 1974. Oh, thanks. That's great. 40 years later, you give Groucho an award. His other brothers are dead, and you give him an award. Now here's another one that, I mean, I agree with this. I totally agree with this, and I think this is a movie that deserved a much better fate than it got. That's Zodiac. I've mentioned Zodiac before, the great David Fincher. And you look, you go back and have you seen Zodiac?
I have, yes.
You go back and watch that movie, and you look at it and go, "This, it's a stunning piece of work. Like it is, it's an astonishingly good movie that tanked when it came out. Like nobody went to see it, and I mean, it got, you know, a decent amount of good reviews, you know, but it didn't, because it's one of the, I mean, it's an amazing movie, and it should have gotten even better reviews. Even the good reviews should have been better. Here it says, another cursed Jake Gyllenhaal gem, Zodiac, sees the actor play real-life newspaper cartoonist on the hunt for the notorious Zodiac killer. The Village Voice wrote that, as an allegory of life in the information age, it blew my mind. It was nominated for the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, but nothing from the Academy. When did Fincher, ever get any, I mean, the Benjamin Button movie got, Social Network is when he finally got all the, did he win the Oscar that year? He did, didn't he?
I don't think so.
No? What won Best Picture that year?
King's Speech won that year.
Oh, God. Of course it did. Benjamin Button, I think, was the first time that Fincher got the recognition, as at least a nomination-wise. And then Social Network, again, he got nominated for that, too. God, King's Speech. Come on, man. What are we talking about here? But, yeah, Zodiac is a great one. Now, here's one I'm really surprised by. It didn't get one nomination. And I'm sure Cochran is very upset about it. But Heat. Now, and that's not, I'm not a fan of the movie, but, I mean, doesn't that seem weird that it wasn't nominated for anything?
Right, that would have seemed like a gimme.
Of course, Michael Mann at that point, Michael Mann, you know, was respected. You know, you got Pacino, De Niro, it's long, it's serious, the cinematography is amazing. I'm really surprised. I did not know that Heat didn't get any nominations. And again, speaking as not a fan of that movie, but here it says, another iconic pairing, this time Al Pacino and Robert De Niro headed up an engrossing crime drama that tore up the streets of L.A. The movie inspired a spate of robberies around the world, as well as the game Grand Theft Auto 5, but it didn't inspire the Academy to nominate nominated for any awards. Really? That's surprising to me. That really, I am truly surprised by that. I thought for sure it would have gotten a few nominations. So, yeah, L.A. Takedown, did that get any Emmys? Do we know if L.A. Takedown got any love from the...
Should have.
For those people who might not have been listening last week, was it last week when we did that?
Yep.
The Heat was actually a remake, because we were talking about remakes, and the Heat was actually a remake of a TV movie that Michael Mann made called L.A. Takedown. So, yeah. Bringing Up Baby. This witty screwball comedy featuring the divine pairing of Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant, but they couldn't even distract from the fact that this brilliant movie flopped upon release, perhaps leading to the Academy snub. Yeah, I mean, I didn't know the history. I didn't know that flopped upon release, but Bringing Up Baby is a great movie. You know, but screwball comedies, again, those kind of things, not going to get the... I mean, look, if Duck Soup doesn't get any love from the Academy in that regard. All right, how about this one? True Romance. Nah, I don't know about this one. Maybe Screenplay? I don't know. Walking, maybe? I don't know. No, Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt's the best performance in that movie. True Romance had a 90s Hollywood cool in abundance, including a script from Quentin Tarantino, a stellar cast including Christian Slater, Patricia Arquette, Dennis Hopper, Gary Oldman, Christopher Walken, Brad Pitt, and a pre-Sopranos James Gandolfini. It might have been too cool. The violent, colorful movie was ignored by the Academy despite rave reviews. I'm not a huge fan of True Romance. Somebody requested that movie at the film club last night. It's like, hey, why don't you show True Romance? I'm like, I'm not really a fan. What?! I thought he was going to kill me. I was like, I like the scene between Dennis Hopper and Christopher Walken, and I think Brad Pitt's hilarious in it, but I'm not crazy about the rest of the movie. But yeah, God, Brad Pitt's funny in that movie. Oh my God. Don't you condescend to me. Why don't you get some cleaning products? I've always thought my issue with that movie was that I thought it was way too slick and flashy, and it overwhelmed what could have been a much grittier movie, and I've always thought Tarantino should have directed it. You know, the script is good. I wouldn't have cast a few of the people in there. I think Patricia Arquette's good in it. I'm not crazy about Christian Slater. But I always thought Tarantino should have directed that movie. Not to speak ill of the dead, Tony Scott. Tony Scott's made some great movies. He made some great movies. But his style is decidedly slick, you know, and it's very flashy. And, you know, some of the material that he used as that, you know, to direct from totally fit. Like, that material totally fit to Tony Scott's visual style and the way he cuts movies and stuff. I just don't think that the True Romance worked with him directing. And that movie was not going to get nominated for maybe screenplay, perhaps. But again, that was before Pulp Fiction. So keep that in mind. Tarantino didn't become an Academy favorite until Pulp Fiction and after. And True Romance, all he did was write anyway. So, all right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more about movies that didn't get any love from the Academy. Yeah, man, Rat! Yeah, Rat! it's Wild Card Wednesday. 217 area code requesting The Great Rat with Round and Round. Do you remember their videos at all, Dan? I think you probably
too. I do not.
Yeah, you were young when they were popular. Here's the weird thing. In two of the Rat's videos, this one included in Round and Round, Milton Berle appeared in them. And that's because they shared the same manager. I don't know how how the hell Rat had the same manager as Milton Berle, or they were related, like somebody's like uncle was there. It was just, there was some sort of connection between Milton Berle, an agent, and maybe somebody who was a relative, and convinced Milton Berle to do the two videos. You know, seeing Milton Berle in a Rat video is pretty special, I got to say. I actually like Rat. I think they're great. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. I'm trying to remember who you know who I saw Rat open for? David Lee Roth.
Wow.
Yeah. There's an 80s right there. There's an 80s concert for you. Rosemont Horizon. Rat opening for David Lee Roth. I saw Rat headline, too, at Poplar Creek. They were awesome. So, how's it going, everybody? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're talking about movies that most people really love and that are now considered great that got no love from the Academy. Here's one, Touch of Evil. Well, no, the Academy never liked Orson Welles. Never liked him. You know, Citizen Kane got nominated for a bunch of awards, obviously, and now widely considered, you know, the greatest movie ever made. And when he won screenplay, they booed at the actual awards ceremony. And Orson Welles' movie, the last movie that he made, took 40 years to make. It was incomplete. Finally, it was completed. It's on Netflix now. But yeah, he never had respect from the Academy. And by the time Touch of Evil came out in 1958, he was box office poison at that point anyway. And I personally, I'm a Touch of Evil guy. I like Touch of Evil better than Citizen Kane. I think Touch of Evil is the best movie Orson Welles has made. A classic era noir from Orson Welles sounds like a cinephile's dream, but both the genre and the director were viewed with suspicion by contemporary Hollywood establishment. It often makes greatest films of all times list, but it was not appreciated at the time. It certainly wasn't. None of his stuff was. Which is why, like, he became so bitter, you know. He was getting this guy, Orson Welles, was one of the greatest filmmakers that's ever lived. He's made some of the greatest movies of all time, but he got no respect from the business he was in at all. None. And it affected him. It affected his behavior. It affected his drinking. He let himself go. He was a beautiful man, you know, like in Citizen Kane. He's a very handsome guy when he was younger, but he let himself go. And then he started, you know, like it by the 70s, he was doing voiceovers on really terrible fake documentaries. He did some voiceovers in some bad cartoons. And then he appeared on, you know, Johnny Carson smoking cigars. He was, and everything was a fat joke. Every time you would see Orson Welles, it was about him being fat. So the history that this guy, you know, cinematically contributed was kind of erased. You know, when I was a kid, I didn't know who the hell Orson Welles was. He was a fat guy on TV. And it wasn't until I started really, really, really getting into movies that I was like, oh, this is the same guy? This fat dude who's on Match Game? This fat guy who's drunk on, doing a wine commercial? He made Citizen Kane? It's a sad story. It really is. It's a tragedy, what, you know, how he was received. And if you've not seen Touch of Evil, everybody, really, it's really, I think it's his best movie. So it's a masterpiece. All right, we got a break. We got the news coming up after this. Just an overwhelming flashback of Ginger's Ale House 1992 just busted into my head. Every 15 minutes that damn song was played. Mike and Woodstock, the Commitments version of Mustang Sally. Yeah, I mean, that was, look, I love the movie. I love that movie. I love the Commitments. It's fantastic. And the band does a fantastic job with the old classics. But, you know, to hear this thing 900 times a night at the, you know, at the bar is a bit much. It's a bit much. But it's a great movie, though. I'm not going to diss on that movie because I love it. Did that movie get nominated for anything? I think it got nominated for screenplay. Back in 1991, The Commitments was released. In 1991. I think it got nominated for screenplay. Because it didn't get nominated for songs because there's no original songs in it. So. Anyway, hey, Dan, you know the story about my friends hanging out with a guy who said that the Commitments version of Try a Little Tenderness is better than the Otis Redding version?
Yes, I do remember you telling that story.
Teleported steak. That's the punchline.
They were nominated for Best Film Editing.
That's it?
That was it.
All right. Well, we're back here now. We're talking about movies that are considered great now that were ignored by the Academy and not even nominated for anything. And we got a quiz coming up after the 4:30 news that Dan's going to give me. Dan, I have to guess the brand. That's the idea.
Brands or famous products.
Okay. That were once not those famous products.
Correct. Okay. Cheerios wasn't always known as Cheerios.
Okay. All right. Cool. We'll do that a little bit later on. So, article in front of me here are it's a bunch of movies that are considered great now that got no love from the Academy. The Lego Movie is next here. Despite winning over both audiences and critics alike, The Lego Movie failed to even pick up a nomination for Best Animated Feature. Co-director Phil Lord responded by building an Oscar statuette out of Lego, posting a picture of it on Twitter with the caption, "It's okay, I made my own." Okay, that's hard to believe that the Lego Movie didn't get nominated for animated feature. And also, how did it not get nominated for original song? How did Everything Is Awesome not get nominated for an original song? That could have got a screenplay nomination too. The Lego Movie is terrific. You seen the trailer for the sequel?
I have not.
It looks great. It does. It looks great. How about this one? King Kong. We're talking about the original. King Kong. How did King Kong not get nominated for anything? The original outing of the enduring monster King Kong is often listed as among the greatest horror movies of all time. It broke ground with its special effects and unique score, but it didn't get a single Oscar nomination, which they belatedly tried to rectify by recognizing the two inferior remakes in subsequent decades. Well, let's not get mean about the Peter Jackson version. But that's insane that King Kong didn't get nominated for anything. That's truly insane. They think Heathers should have been nominated. There's no way Heathers was going to be nominated for an Academy Award. Winona Ryder shown in this jet black comedy about a monstrous high school clique. The movie gained generally positive reviews, but really flourished as an underground cult hit. That's not going to make a difference with that movie. There was no possible way that Heathers would be nominated for anything in the world of Academy Awards. My Own Private Idaho. See, great movie, but that's not Oscar. That's not an Academy Award movie. It's a great movie. I mean, a really, really great movie. And one of three great movies that Keanu made in 1 year. 1991 was a great year for Keanu Reeves because he not only was in My Own Private Idaho, but he was in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, which I like more than the first one. And, of course, Point Break, which should have gotten 14 Oscar nominations as far as I'm concerned. Here's what they say. A landmark of new queer cinema, My Own Private Idaho starred dreamy duo River Phoenix and Keanu Reeves and Gus Van Sant's avant-garde story of young street hustlers. The gorgeous drifting movie did well at an Independent Spirit Awards, but the Academy wasn't quite ready for a movie that, at the time, felt taboo. Yeah, that's, I mean, clear. That's a movie that's going to dominate at the Independent Spirit Awards. I mean, that kind of goes without saying. Another Stanley Kubrick movie, Paths of Glory. Stanley Kubrick's brilliant anti-war movie follows Kirk Douglas as a commanding officer who defends his soldiers who refuse to be a part of a suicidal attack. It's been critically acclaimed, but it failed to impress the Academy. Again, that's another surprising one for me. You know? Modern Times. No love from the Academy. We're talking about Charlie Chaplin here. Charlie Chaplin wrote, directed, and starred in this visually stunning, mostly silent exploration of the industrial age, which was a deeply critical and capitalist exploitation of that still elicited belly laughs. Sadly, it was slightly out of sync with the era, which was embracing the new sound technology, and it was overlooked by the Academy. When sound broke through, a lot of the really great silent movies of that particular era, not the earlier silence, but that particular era, did get ignored. When the talkies came about, everybody wanted talkies. But I mean, you can't deny Modern Times. I mean, come on. Rushmore. Wait a minute. Bill Murray didn't get nominated for Rushmore? I thought Bill Murray got nominated for Rushmore. Wes Anderson's debut established his unique voice and visual flair and has far more resonant emotional core than his stunning, cold later work. But not even the presence of Bill Murray could ensure an Oscar nod. Wow! I made a mistake at the Scrooge screening last night because I said that Bill Murray got nominated for an Academy Award for that movie. Well, what's he been nominated for? Was he nominated for Lost in Translation?
I will double check that. Okay. But for Rushmore, it was the Golden Globes that he was nominated opposed to the Oscars.
He was nominated for the Globes. Speaking of the Golden Globes, tomorrow morning the Golden Globes nominations are announced. And we'll talk about it on a special Friday appearance by Dan Feinberg. We have a lot of TV stuff to talk about. We'll talk about that on Friday morning in addition to the Globe nominations that we'll talk about. We'll cover TV with Feinberg, and then we'll talk movies after we talk with Dan. But yeah, the Golden Globes. So Bill Murray, I mean, he's been nominated, right? Or has he not been nominated?
Nominated for Lost in Translations, and that is it.
That's it. Okay. I thought he was nominated for Rushmore. I really did. I'm sorry, Film Club. Nobody questioned me. I was surprised. Normally, when I make a mistake like that, somebody in the audience goes, "No." They actually included Anchorman in this. Like Anchorman had a chance of being nominated for anything. It's not easy to make a good movie, which is both completely silly and objectively good, but the Academy seems to believe otherwise. A classic example of the goofy comedies which proliferated during the aughts. This infinitely quotable movie lives on despite its zero Oscar. Now, there was no way whoever wrote that entry is delusional. There's no way that Anchorman. Now, if Adam McKay made Anchorman now because he won an Oscar for The Big Short. By the way, Dan, did I tell you I watched Vice?
I saw your post about it.
Oh my God, I can't officially review it, but it sucks. I was so disappointed. I was very excited about it. Only good thing in it, Sam Rockwell. He plays George W. Bush in it. He's like three scenes, though. There's like not enough of him at all. I was really disappointed. I was really angry because I liked The Big Short. I thought The Big Short was good. I had some issues with some of it. And all the issues that I had with The Big Short are all the mistakes he makes in Vice, but multiplies it by like 1,000. So I was really disappointed with that. I was really looking forward to it. He'll never make a better movie than the other guys, as far as I'm concerned. Now that should be on here. That's the movie that the other guys is the movie that Adam McKay should have been nominated for. Here's one that just sickens me. You ready for me to be sick? His Girl Friday, no Oscar love. Again, I guess the Oscars just don't like this. They don't like the screwball comedies. His Girl Friday is one of the greatest movies ever made. One of my favorite films of all time. One of like my top five of all time. His Girl Friday. This classic screwball comedy follows a newspaper editor played by the ever slick Cary Grant, who is on a mission to win back his ace reporter ex-wife, played by Rosalind Russell. Russell's independent, wisecracking character who drives the narrative, and is truly Grant's equal, seemed radical, even in 2018, perhaps too radical, the Academy ignored it completely. It's an example of, that's one of those things where it's like, yeah, hey, you want to see a perfect movie? Let me suggest a perfect movie for you. It's this movie called His Girl Friday. Everything about it is great. Every single thing about it is great. It brings me joy every time I watch it. And it's so incredibly well made and well acted, and the timing is so extraordinary. And the rapid fire dialogue. I mean, the movie is like less than 2 hours, a little bit less than 2 hours, and I think it feels like it's a 700-page script. And it's just the timing back and forth between the dialogue, the snappy dialogue. I will say this. His Girl Friday was the most influential. That was the movie that influenced my directing in theater the most than any other movie in terms of, like, you know, like snappy dialogue and being fast. And I mean, obviously, I never reached my direction, never reached the pinnacle of Howard Hawks, but I was inspired by trying to do that. So I directed a lot of pale imitations of His Girl Friday type stuff while I was with the factory. But, you know, you watch that movie, and I watch it to this day, and it's a joyous movie. His Girl Friday, one of the greatest movies of all time. We showed that one at our film club already. I'd show it every month if I could. But you watch that movie, and while you're watching it, and you're witnessing what's going on, and the banter between the characters, I sometimes am out of breath, and I'm just sitting on my couch watching it. Like, after certain scenes, I'm like, how the hell, you know. And no Oscar love for that. Ridiculous. All right, we got a couple more here, and then we're going to talk about the biggest movies in box office history, and it's adjusted for inflation. And during that conversation, or any of the conversations, if you want to jump in with movies that you love, 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 that you've seen over and over again, that maybe didn't get the love that they deserved, but you love them, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Ken in Milwaukee. What's the name of these guys?
Arrogant Worms.
Oh, Arrogant Worms. Okay, Arrogant Worms with Me Like Hockey. All right. Me Like Hockey, that's why me is showing Slapshot in January. January 8th, Slapshot, AMC, Rosemont 18. $10 to get in. Parking is free. Tickets will be on sale soon at amctheaters.com. The classic Slapshot on the big screen, January 8th. That's my next film clip. Make sure you come out for that. Wildcard Wednesday continues. That's any artist, any song, anything. 312-981-7200. Live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. We're here until 5 o'clock. Coming up, Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. And also coming up, The Stories That Matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. We're back, and we're talking about movies that most people really love but got no love from the Academy. And we're going to wrap that up here. a couple of more Coen Brothers movies that are listed here in this article. Blood Simple, the directorial debut of the Coen Brothers, is a violent, funny neo-noir crime thriller that had modest box office success on release. Critics loved it, but their praise wasn't enough to persuade the Academy. Yeah, that was another one of those movies that, boy, I remember the first time I saw Blood Simple. That, you know, was the first time I saw it. I remember thinking to myself, these guys, who are these Coen guys, these Coen brothers, and one of the most impressive directorial debuts I've ever seen. Now, at that time, for their first bunch of movies, Joel Coen was listed as director. He was the only director listed. They both were listed as writers, but Joel Coen was listed as the only director. And now they're both listed as directors and writers on their movies. And that just happened recently because the first large batch of their movies, it was just Joel Coen who received the credit. But I remember thinking that's one of the greatest directorials I've ever seen, one of the most assured directorials I've ever seen. And then they mentioned, of course, Miller's Crossing, another brilliant Coen Brothers neo-noir, which was snubbed by the Oscars. Miller's Crossing explores a power struggle between rival gangs. The brothers didn't win an Oscar until 1997 with Fargo when they won screenplay. Because that was in 96, I think that was the year that the damn English Patient won, I think. I think that was the year of the English Patient. Elaine Bennis's favorite movie, The English Patient. I hate it! Okay, fine, you're fired. All right, great, I'll be outside. I'll be outside. Oh, boy. All right. We got a few more here, but we got people calling in. Jim is on WGN. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how you doing tonight?
All right.
I was just growing up. I'm not surprised the Academy didn't give it an award, but Zombieland is a movie that, if it comes on, I can't turn it off. It's just, it's good on every level. Any yeah. movie where a guy's trying to get a Twinkie.
Yep.
And that's the main focus. And then it's a movie where you want to see a sequel, and you know there probably won't ever be one.
No, there is. There is. Yeah. They're actually, I think the script is finalized. I know that, who was the holdout? It was Jesse Eisenberg, right?
Okay.
Dan,
I can't remember if it was Eisenberg or someone else. I thought it was something funny where it had been like Abigail Breslin, who's not working
right.
too much, was the one that we didn't want to do it. But right. I'll double check on that.
Yeah, but Emma Stone is on board. I know Emma Stone is on board. But you know, that movie came up, Jim, that movie, Zombieland, came up at my screening last night because I showed Scrooge and we were talking about Bill Murray. And
yes.
Everybody talks about the Bill Murray cameo in that movie as being like one of the greatest cameos of all time.
I was never very good at practical jokes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great movie.
I hope there's some way they can bring him back in the sequel, maybe as a friendly zombie or something.
Well, see, that's the thing. Maybe as an actual zombie, not as Bill Murray pretending to be a zombie. Because they do kill him in the movie, and then that is such a hilarious moment when he actually kills the real Bill Murray.
Yes. I'm glad they're making a sequel. I'm glad you guys know that.
So yeah, awesome. They are. But the thing is that the other thing about the Bill Murray cameo is that there's a whole nother level to it, because it's this. This great reunion of Kingpin, because it's Woody Harrelson and Bill Murray.
Yes. Another great movie.
Tremendous movie. All right, Jim, thanks.
Take care.
Yeah, there's another one, Dan. You know what? That's snubbed. Kingpin, best picture, best actor, best supporting actor, screenplay. Come on, you kidding me? Kingpin. I will say this, though. There's a strong chance that one of the directors of Kingpin could get nominated this year, because Peter Farrelly by himself directed Green Book, which, by the way, more people need to see. What is wrong with you people? All right, here's Rich on WGN. Hi, Rich.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Well, I'll tell you, one movie that got snubbed was Jim Cotta. Well, got to throw that in.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree.
Yeah. But two and a half, The Kingdom of Mind definitely was one, being Birdie.
Yeah.
Matthew Modine and
Nicolas Cage. Yeah.
That was a sweet movie and nice photography and just some pretty earnest acting in it.
Oh, it's a great movie. Great movie. Completely bombed at the box office. Nobody saw that movie when it came out. I remember Roy Leonard hosted a screening of it, and because he loved it so much, he had seen it, and then he hosted a screening of it, and we had a talk afterwards. About it. It was in a screening room downtown, not even in a movie theater, because he loved the movie. Roy really championed that movie. He really got behind that film, and he talked about it as much as he possibly could.
Yeah, and I saw it on video, and I saw it way after it was in the theater.
Nobody saw it in the theater. Seriously, I think it was out for 2 weeks in the theater. But it's a terrific movie, and it's one. Both Modine and Nicolas Cage are great in it. Like, really,
absolutely,
great. Yeah. Yeah, it's a
great... the other one, and I believe this is Kirk Douglas's alleged favorite movie of his own performance. Can you care to take a guess what it is?
No, which one?
It's Lonely Are the Brave.
Ah, no, that's a great...
Which is a great, great movie.
My favorite Kirk Douglas movie is Ace in the Hole. Have you ever seen Ace in the Hole, Rich?
Oh, no, I have not.
Look it up.
Okay.
Billy Wilder wrote and directed it. He plays a ruthless reporter. And I won't tell you any more, but it's called Ace in the Hole. And I guarantee
I'll check that out.
I guarantee you'll like it. I guarantee it. So,
all right. I definitely love that guy. Can I give you one more? That's a half snub.
Go ahead.
Forgive me for mispronouncing his name. Isley Morales.
S.A. Morales.
When he played the brother of Richie Valens in La Bamba, what a great performance.
A great performance. Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
Yep.
All right, Rich, thanks. Right. Take care.
You bet. Yeah. Bye.
Yeah. By the way, S.A. Morales was the main bad guy in Bad Boys, the good Bad Boys with Sean Penn, not the crappy Bad Boys with Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. And we'll close out with this one because, I just want to close out with this one from this article. They include Airplane. Now, again, one of the greatest comedies ever made. Funny every time you watch it. I've seen Airplane 900 times, and I laugh every time. But there was no possible way that would be nominated. It was a box office smash. But this disaster farce perfected a blend of slapstick comedy and slippery, surreal gags to create a fast-paced, inventive satire. Although it's been voted the best comedy ever made by many, it didn't get an Oscar nod. So, all right. Let's take a break. We got the news coming up, and then I'm going to tell you about the biggest box office movies of all time, and they're adjusted for inflation. And what movies do you love that you watch over and over again that maybe nobody else loves or sees? All right, that's coming up after the news. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Wednesday, Wildcard Wednesday. That's Jay requesting Bing Crosby with the Bells of St. Mary. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Dan's going to give me a pop quiz after the 4:30 news, but right now I'm going to go through the 20 highest grossing movies of all time. They've been adjusted for inflation, and if you want to jump in with some of your favorite movies that you can watch, you know, over and over and over again. We were talking about movies that people love that got no love from the Oscars, and what are ones that you can watch over and over again that maybe aren't as popular. But here are the highest grossing movies of all time. I'll start with number 20 and work my way up. And we can talk a little bit about these. Number 20 is The Sting from 1973. The best picture of 1973 was also a big winner at the box office, generating $788,022,900 in ticket sales. That's with the adjustment. Now, here's the thing. Movies are making more money than ever these days. And lots of movies are hitting the $500 million mark in record numbers. And so these lists are bound to change, especially if something really kicks butt at the box office. But again, these are not, you know, this $788 million dollars is not 1973 money. It did not make $788 million in 1973. Number 19 is The Lion King. The beloved animated classic roared its way into the all-time top 20 with $788,054,400. And I was relatively unimpressed with the trailer for the live-action one. Of course, I was relatively unimpressed with the original. I was never a huge fan. Dan, has Emily seen The Lion King?
No, but I was that came out right at the right time for me. So
I'm
really excited to see that with her. I'll probably show her the animated version before I show her the probably
live. You go to the live-action version, yeah. Well... Yeah. I mean, it's not, I don't hate it. I'm not as thrilled with the animated, well, the original version as everybody else seemed to be. I thought Jeremy Irons did a nice job as Scar, you know, but I loved the Broadway musical.
Yeah. They did a really nice job.
Man, I thought that was awesome. I mean, yeah. All right. Number 18. God, Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. George Lucas, with The Phantom Menace, it took in $798,358,700, despite the presence of Jar Jar Binks. Well, that was, I mean, how many years were people waiting? Right? Because Jedi came out in 83. That came out in 99. So, you know, people were waiting for 15 years for that movie. And I remember when I saw Phantom Menace and the theater, you know, the before the screening, it was I went to a critic screening of it, but it was like a public/critic screening, like sponsored by a radio station. But you could the energy in that room, like the excitement, was palpable. I was never a really big Star Wars fan, but even I got caught up in the excitement. I was like, "Wow, this is pretty exciting." I got to admit, I'm not a big Star Wars guy, but I was pretty excited. And so the movie starts and everybody's very excited. You hear the overture start. You hear the classic John Williams overture start, and then you see the crawl telling the story. People were like, people were very, very excited. You could feel it, but man, did the energy get sucked out of that room as that movie kept going? I mean, you could just feel people starting to hate it. I remember. Mike View went to go see it. He's a huge Star Wars fan. He was very, very excited. He couldn't believe that it was bad because he went to see it, and he saw it a second time in the theater. He went back and saw it a second time because he would not believe that it was that bad. And I think he saw it three times. I think he went back a third time and went, okay, yes, this does suck. Because I think he refused to believe it sucked because the first three Star Wars movies were so important to him, you know, in his childhood. He was the right age, you know. But he told me a story one of the times he went to go see it is at the Webster Place. He's at the Webster Place, and the movie's going along, the movie's chugging along, and just like every time anybody went to go see Phantom Menace in the theater, you know, the audience starts out rooting for it, you know, hoping it's good, being excited, and then slowly that all begins to change. Slowly the audience starts to get restless, become disappointed, and in some cases near the end of the movie just get completely angry. And that happened regularly. But my favorite is Mike's watching the movie, and they've got the scene. You're gonna have to remind Dan, you're gonna have to sort of help me out here, remind me. They did some kind of test on it with this Jedi juice or something with the kids and Liam Neeson's.
Yeah, midichlorians or something.
Well, yeah, to test his Jedi juice. and it's like off the charts, you know, like it's, oh, the kids are, oh, he's got more Jedi juice than Jamba juice. I don't know. So anyway, and so Ewan McGregor is having a conversation with Liam Neeson's. And so Ewan McGregor goes, who's his father? And Liam Neeson's goes, he didn't have a father. Okay, so an obvious, you know, allusion to Jesus and an attempt to layer some sort of allegory within what is really a stupid movie. So he says, that happens about halfway through the movie, more than halfway through the movie. So by this point, the audience has, you know, they've lost the audience. So this guy who's like been audibly groaning through the movie, sitting a couple of rows in front of my friend Mike, is just like, while it was, you know, like what stupid stuff is happening, the Jar Jar thing, and he's like, oh man, oh, and he's like moving around in his seat very uncomfortably, and he's very upset. So finally, he can't take it anymore, and so when he says he didn't have a father, the guy screams out, "Oh yeah, now he's Jesus!" And then the same guy at the end of the movie, when it ended, he stood up, turned around, and looked at the audience and said, "Who else thought that sucked?"
That's fantastic.
The guy just couldn't take it anymore. He just couldn't take. Oh yeah, now he's Jesus. Brian says Gymkhana. Yes, I understand. I understand, Brian. Carolyn in St. Petersburg says, "I've always loved Out of Africa with Meryl Streep and Robert Redford." We talked about that one a little bit earlier, beating Color Purple that year. David says Brazil. You can watch that one over and over again. 630 area code says, "I can watch The Commitments over and over again. I usually watch it around St. Patrick's Day along with The Quiet Man." Okay. Next on the list, 17, is Jurassic Park. While Jurassic World, the fourth installment in the Jurassic Park series, currently holds the 24th spot on the all-time highest grossing list, it is Jurassic Park that made $812 million, $590,100. Next is Return of the Jedi. Star Wars movie, the franchise's third release, made an impressive $831,485,200. And this, again, is adjusted for inflation. And then we'll continue with number 15, and that's Avatar, which is James Cameron's echo-minded sci-fi film. And it went up to $859,736,600. $736,600, and I don't understand that. I don't get the Avatar thing. I really don't. You know, because that, you know, nobody talks about Avatar as being a. Does anybody, Dan? Do you know anybody who says, "Oh yeah, what's one of your favorite movies?" Avatar. Nobody ever says that.
Nobody.
Nobody talks about it, and there, you know, there are like, even Phantom Menace you talked about because it sucked. But, like, nobody talks about Avatar, and yet it broke all kinds of box office records. It's a terrible movie. Avatar is a terrible movie that, as I've said before, was written by a bunch of drunk monkeys. Not even sober monkeys. Drunk monkeys wrote that movie. It's one of the dumbest movies I have ever seen in my life. And when I saw it, I was stunned at how stupid it was. Like, taken aback by how stupid Avatar was. And then every week, looking at the box office going, What is going on? Who's seeing this movie and why? So, I don't know. But sometimes really stupid movies or really bad movies catch on for some reason. Like right now, Bohemian Rhapsody is that movie because I hate that movie. I hate that movie. And yet it's making a ton of money. Much more than anybody ever expected a movie about Queen to make. It surpassed any kind of expectations by far. But that's the one right now where every time I look at the box office, I'm going, why are... Venom is another one from this year. Who the hell? Why were people going back? Why? Nobody liked it. I don't know anybody who liked it. I don't know any critics who gave it a good review. And yet it was consistently making good numbers while it was out. People are weirdos. All right, let's break for the weather. We'll come back, wrap up the biggest movies ever made, and then Dan, after the 4:30 news, is going to give me a quiz, and we'll see how well I do. I'm surprisingly lucid right now.
Yeah, you made it good way.
Yeah. And I had very much no sleep over the...
There it is.
There it goes. All right. We're back. It's Wild Card Wednesday wrapping up here. Yeah, Wild Card Wednesday. And that's any artist, any song, anything. And it's 773 air code requesting The Clash with Rock the Casbah, which is a great song. Okay, we are coming back here on WGN, and we're here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and we're in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we got a little quiz here action coming up after the news. But now we're talking about the 20 biggest movies ever made money-wise, and these are all obviously adjusted for inflation so that they represent what they would have made now. Avatar came in at 15. 14, Ben-Hur. William Wyler's Sword and Sandal Spectacular was a hit with audiences, generating $866,320,000 in ticket sales. Wow, that's huge. That's huge. Ben-Hur ahead of Jedi and Jurassic Park. You know, wow. A lot of people saw that movie. 13 is Empire Strikes Back, which is the second film released in the Star Wars franchise. $867,916,800. $101 Dalmatians comes in. And, wow, that was that big? $101 Dalmatians was that big? $101 Dalmatians barked up $883,268,500 between its original 1961 release and its four re-releases in 69, 79, 85, and 91. Number 11 on the list is Star Wars, The Force Awakens. And that's the newest film on the list. And The Force Awakens rang up $955,737,500. Next on the list is Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, coming in at number 10. It's the oldest film on the list, $963,560,000. Number 9 is The Exorcist. Groundbreaking horror movie is the genre's first to score Best Picture Oscar nomination. It lost to The Sting, but it won at the box office with a grand total of $977,696,600. Yeah, people forget that was a total phenomenon when it came out. I mean, everybody went to see it. There were lines around the block. I remember my parents, when they went to see it, they waited in line for like an hour and a half outside, and it was like December or January when they went, so out of the gateway. When my dad and I went, we didn't have to wait very long. When my dad secretly took me to see The Exorcist when I was 8. Next, number 8, Dr. Zhivago. Despite being banned in Russia, the country in which it's set, until 1994, the epic drama romance from David Lean made $1,970,367,400. Number 7 is Jaws, which made over $1 billion in ticket sales. 10 Commandments comes in at number 6 with over $1,100,000,000. Number 5 is Titanic, which is still amazing. And it's also amazing, Dan, that you've not seen that movie, despite the fact that you love the song, as we always talk about.
Yep.
Very close to $1.2 billion. $1.2 billion Titanic made. And people went back over and over and saw it again and again and again. It was in theaters forever.
Just for the song.
That's right, exactly. Number 4 is E.T. the Extraterrestrial with over $1.25 billion, the biggest movie of 1982. Number 3 is The Sound of Music. Hills Are Alive with the sound of over $1,258,000,000. Number 2, Star Wars. With what a big jump between Sound of Music and Star Wars, $1,574,000,000 That's a big jump. And then the biggest movie of all, and it's also a big jump from Star Wars, the biggest movie of all is still Gone with the Wind. And you have to understand, when that movie came out, I think it was like a nickel to see a movie. So think about that. It's like people are paying a nickel or maybe a dime to see a movie, and it still made, even with adjustments, over $1,786 million. That means a lot of people saw that movie in the theater. And it's another one. That got a few re-releases, and every time it got re-releases, more and more people saw it. So it wasn't just that initial run in 1939. But still, the fact that movies nowadays make so much money so quickly, and they make more money than ever before, the fact that Gone with the Wind is still solidly the highest grossing movie of all time and the biggest movie ever made, it really says something about how many people love that movie and see it and saw it. So there they are. Gone with the Wind still reigns supreme in that world. So, okay, we got a break here for the news, which is coming up in just a couple minutes. Michael in Iowa and Peter in Decatur requested Barbra Streisand's Jingle Bells, and then Peter says that Vic hates this song. Vic, do you hate that version? Do you hate the Barbra Streisand version of Jingle Bells?
Oh, that's right. Yes, I do recall expressing my hatred of that version.
Yeah. Mary, do you hate that version?
Yes.
Me too.
Vic and I were just like cringing when it came on. We're like, jingle bell. No. It gives you a headache.
No, I can't stand it either.
Reminded you of that I hate that? I think I must have said that a year ago.
Yeah, Peter in Decatur. Peter in Decatur is one of our most dedicated listeners. Let me just say that. He contributes all the time to our Friday features. He listens intently all the time. He's one of our best listeners. So, yeah, if any of our listeners are going to remember something you said a year ago, Vic, it's going to be
Peter in Decatur.
Exactly. Exactly. But I can't stand that version either. It makes me nuts. So,
it's not one of Babs' best.
No, it's not. And it's, yes, Babs is capable of much, much better.
Yes.
Much, much better.
It's so. Like a rap version of Babs.
Yeah, I don't know who decided that was the arrangement that they should use, and that's the style in which she should sing it. But
what style is that? Like, I have something to do after this style.
So yeah, let's
get the heck out of here.
Let's get this song over with.
Right. Me criticizing Barbra Streisand. Maybe I should just keep my mouth shut. She seems to be doing okay.
She's fine. So, all right. Well, there you go. Vic and Mary and I all hate that song. Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Michael. Oh, I hate that version of that song. We don't hate Jingle Bells. So, hey, welcome back, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. And, Dan, you are we set to give me some quiz here and test my brains at this point that they are not mush?
Yes.
Because I slept like 2 hours and 14 days? Well, that's not true, but I had my screening, my Films Club screening, and I very rarely get enough rest. And I had an early Film Club screening because we had a lovely gathering at the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant 2 hours before the regular screening started. So I have even less sleep in me. So let's see how we do here. Now, explain what the quiz is.
The quiz is titled, Can You Guess What These Popular Brands Were Originally Called?
Can you guess what these popular brands were originally called?
Yes, we have 14 in total.
Is it multiple choice?
It is multiple choice.
That makes it much better for me as an idiot. So, all right, well, shall we begin?
We begin with, from 1893 to 1898, inventor Caleb Bradham called Pepsi by another name. It was sold as Big Gulp, Brad's Drink, Fizz-A-Lot, or Peppy. What is the original name of Pepsi? Big Gulp, Brad's Drink, Fizz-A-Lot, or Peppy?
I'm going to say Fizz-A-Lot.
You are incorrect. Brad's Drink.
Oh, that was a real original. That's a real original name for the product. That's a very descriptive, you know, very clever name. Yeah, Brad. I'm going to call it Brad. I'm Brad, and I'm going to call it Brad's Drink. Okay. Wow. Brad's Drink. You know what? The next time I have a, I don't drink Pepsi, but the next time I order a Pepsi, I'm just going to go, can you give me a Brad's Drink? All right. I'm doing real well so far.
That's all right. That was a tough one. Mail order maven Edwin Perkins started marketing Kool-Aid in the 1920s. Before settling on that name in 1928, he called his flavoring Instafruit, Cool Brew, Fruit Smack, or Water Aid.
I'm going to say Instafruit.
Instafruit is incorrect. Fruit Smack.
Fruit Smack.
Fruit Smack. He's always been very violent, crashing into walls, smacking people.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I should have said Fruit Smack. That fits in.
Right.
Well, how come they didn't call it Brad's Drink? Wait, what was this guy's name?
Let me see if I can go back here without losing our spot.
Was it Mike? He should have just called it Mike's Flavoring.
Mike's Flavoring.
Yeah. All right.
Hang on one second.
Okay. All right, I'm doing real well here. I'm 0-2.
Edwin. Edwin's drink.
Edwin's seasoning.
Edwin's flavoring.
Edwin's flavoring. Wow. All right. Brad's drink.
General Mills introduced their puffed oat cereal in 1941, but it wasn't named Cheerios until 1945.
Ah.
For 4 years, it was sold under the name Puffles, Opti Oats, Oat Mazing, or Cherry Oats.
I'm going to go Opti Oats.
Opti Oats is incorrect.
What?
Cherry Oats.
They don't take. Oh, so what? He changed it from cherry.
They just dropped the oats.
But Cheerios don't taste like cherry.
No, but that's. I don't know if it was. That's what they were going for.
All right. Cheerios. So
they dropped the ATS.
I see. Okay. All right. I got it. All right, let's see if I can go 0-14. That's you said 14 questions,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Let's see if I can go 0-14 this morning. I'm acquitting myself really impressively at this point. Good God. All right.
Chemist Robert Kesebrough trademarked this soothing petroleum goop as known as Vaseline in 1872. Prior to that, he called it Vaseline, Wonder Jelly, Wonder Bomb. Stay Soft.
Wonder Bomb.
Wonder Bomb is incorrect. Wonder Jelly.
Oh, I was going to go with Wonder Jelly. Remember Wonder Jelly used to do sports for us on the morning show? Yeah, man, time for sports with Wonder Jelly.
Good college guy.
Yeah, good old Wonder Jelly. Isn't that a new DC movie coming out? Wonder Jelly?
Yeah.
Is that what it
will also be snubbed by the Oscars?
Is that what Gal Gadot puts on her toast? Is that that's what she put? Hold on a minute. Now, hang on. Hold it. All right.
You don't get that kind of comedy on 2 hours and 14 days.
Oh, that's true. All right. What do we got now?
Namco had an arcade hit with Pac-Man in 1980.
I think I know this one.
But only after changing the name from Puckman, Pellet Man, Ghost and Goblin, Gobblin, or Mr. Chomp Chomp.
No, I don't know this one.
Here are your options again. What was the former name of Pac-Man? Puckman, Pellet Man, Ghost and Goblin, Gobblin, or Mr. Chomp Chomp.
I'm going to go with Mr. Chomp Chomp.
Mr. Chomp Chomp would be incorrect.
Jeez.
Puckman.
Really? Because he looks like a hockey puck?
You know, unfortunately, they don't explain what the original names are.
What they mean?
Yeah, or like the etymology, at least.
Yeah, but Puckman, I mean, he does resemble a puck, and it actually makes more sense than Pac-Man, really.
That's true.
You know what I mean? What is a Pac-Man? What's Pac-Man? He looks like a puck, so that actually is a better, I think that's a better name. But then it would be Puckman Fever. So, I don't know. Maybe the NHL said, hey! No! Well, the NHL doesn't own the word puck. That's a otherwise Don Rickles would have been sued 9,000 times. All right, one more before we break.
All right. Leo Gertzenzang.
Yeah, he's a buddy of mine. Leo and I go way back. We had a lot of Brad's drinks. Yeah.
Well, the timing would be appropriate because he introduced these baby-friendly swabs in 1923.
Yeah.
He eventually called them Q-tips,
mm-hmm.
but not before selling them under the name Cotton Cushions, Wax Offs, Baby Sticks, or Baby Gays.
Baby what?
Gays.
Gays?
Yes, G-A-Y-S.
Wow. I'm Baby Sticks.
Incorrect. What baby
is,
Gays.
Is baby Gays. Now, do you know what the Q in Q-tip stand for?
I do not.
Quality.
Ah.
Yes.
Don't use them in your ear, people, by the way.
No, don't. You don't stick them in your ear.
Public service announcement.
Yeah. Don't do that. Digging into your ear with a Q-tip. That'll give you quality hearing damage is what that'll do. Well, how many questions have been asked so far? What number are we on?
It does not indicate.
Oh, okay.
Oh, seven.
Seven. Oh,
so
good.
We're halfway through,
and I am 0-7, and running strong to the finish line to go 0-14. Stay tuned, everybody. This is exciting. Let's see if I can answer a question correctly. We got the weather here. Wow. Wild Card Wednesday continues to be wild.
Yeah.
Wrapping up with this, and that's Steve requesting the Lord's bright blessing from the Scrooge animated special. That's Mr. Magoo is Scrooge, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe you are correct.
Yeah. All right. Welcome back, everybody. And again, speaking of Scrooge, I want to thank everybody for coming out last night to the screening of Bill Murray and Scrooged. We had a great time, and beforehand, we went, a bunch of us, a great many of us went to the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant in the Crown Plaza Hotel and had a fantastic dinner, and it was wonderful, and they gave us a 15% discount, and it was just a great night all the way around. Good dinner, great place at the Caddyshack, and then Bill Murray and Scrooge. Lots of fun last night. Thank you, everybody, for coming out. Slapshot is next. That'll be January 8th. Paul Newman in one of the greatest comedies of all time, Slapshot. So we'll give you more details as it gets closer. That's coming up. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. So I'm not doing well, Dan. I'm not doing well at all.
Tough go so far.
I'm not having a good time trying to guess what the old brand names of items used to be. 0-7, so 7 more to go. Let's see if I can keep that perfect record going.
Before we move away too far, multiple texters are letting us know that Puckman was changed to Pac-Man by the request of arcade cabinet owners who were worried that the P could easily be changed to another letter.
I see. Okay, no, that makes sense.
Very much so.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Here we go.
The Big Mac was invented by McDonald's franchisee Jim Delagatti in 1967. He called it the Aristocrat, the Super Burger, the Mouth Pleaser, or the McDouble.
I'm sorry. Mouth Pleaser is the most ridiculous thing. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life.
But...
Yeah, mouth
not
pleaser.
Wrong.
Yeah. I like that. That's not it, though. It can't be it. I'm going to go with the... what was the second one?
The Super Burger.
That's what I'm going to go with.
That
Super
is
Burger.
Incorrect.
What is it?
The Aristocrat.
Oh. I was hoping it was going to be... If I wasn't right, I wanted it to be Mouth Pleaser. That's fantastic. Oh, man. I'm doing miserably at this. Okay.
Next question. Dentist William Morrison helped conceive of this chewy treat that was later known as cotton candy.
Wait, a dentist invented that?
I do remember hearing this, that a dentist created cotton
candy. That's unbelievable. Like the worst possible thing for your teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay.
When it was introduced in the late 1800s, so maybe the dentistry world was not as advanced.
No. Clearly. Clearly, if a... Clearly, it's not very advanced. A dentist invented cotton candy, but it was called something else.
Yes. Your options are candy fluff, cloud candy, fairy floss, or sticky sweet.
Well, I'm going to just take a guess here because it was invented by a dentist, and I'm going to call it fairy floss. I'm going to say fairy floss.
That is correct.
Yes, I finally got one. Well, that's just, you know, that's, I was trying to use what little logic I have in my noggin. I tried to use to, like, figure out, well, the guy's a dentist. But see, that's the worst dentist ever. He used the word floss to describe what was essentially cotton candy.
Yes.
Like, it's okay for kids to floss with cotton candy. Well, you know why? Because you floss with cotton candy, you're going to have a lot of room between your teeth because they're going to fall out.
It's like those people who are saying that, you know, dentists on Halloween should be giving away candy because it increases their work.
Yeah, exactly. You get more business. I can't believe a dentist invented cotton candy. That's fantastic. That is a great piece of trivia. Oh, all right.
Eggo waffles.
Oh, boy.
Rolled out to stores in 1953, but consumers couldn't let go their Eggo just yet. For the first 2 years, the waffles were called Weggos, Munchums, Toasties, or Froffles?
Froffles?
Yes. Again, your options are Weggos, Munchums, Toasties, or Froffles.
I'm going to say Toasties.
Toasties is incorrect. Froffles.
Froffles?
Froffles. Froffles.
Oh, so it was French toast, or no, French, maybe French toast and waffles?
Maybe, yeah.
That's probably what, right?
You'd imagine.
French toast and waffles? Okay. Boy, I got one. Hey, I got one, Dan.
Yep. The Frisbee spent a few months in the late 1950s being marketed as the Flying Saucer, Pluto Platter, Discus, or the Flyby.
I'm going to go with Pluto Platter.
You are correct.
Wow. That had nothing to do with any knowledge on my part whatsoever.
Just like alliteration.
Yeah. Pluto Platter. Hey, do you know this is a true thing? Do you know that the guy who invented the Frisbee, I just heard this weird fact on a game show. I can't remember what game show it was, but the question was, is it true or false that the guy who invented the Frisbee, when he died, he was cremated and his ashes were formed into a Frisbee?
Really?
And that's true. Yeah. Unfortunately, he ended up on a neighbor's roof. Hold on a minute. Hold on a second. Wait.
All right.
I can't. Hold on. All right.
The classic word game Scrabble took off in the 1950s, but not before inventor Alfred M. Butts.
B-U-T-T-Z?
S. B-U-T-T-S.
No, come on, really? That's his... B-U-T-T-S?
B-U-T-T-S.
All right.
Tried another name. Alfred called it Word Soup, Word Play, Tile Scramble, or Criss-Cross Words.
Boy, that's tough. I mean, it could be any one of those, right?
Correct. Word Soup, Word Play, Tile Scramble, or Criss-Cross Words.
I'm going to go with Tile Scramble.
Tile Scramble is incorrect. Criss-Cross Words.
Criss-Cross Words. Well, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. See, I went with it, and my logic was Tile Scramble is similar to Scrabble. So I thought maybe that's why they just changed. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't right.
Yeah. But before taking its name from the Greek goddess of victory, Nike opened for business in 1964 by selling shoes under the name Swish, Blue Ribbon Sports, Swoop.
Or Soup?
Swoop.
Oh, Swoop.
Swoop, S-W-O-O-P.
Oh, okay.
Or Ultimate Sport. So again, your options are Swish, Blue Ribbon Sports, Swoop.
I'm going to go with Blue Ribbon Sports.
You are correct.
Because, you know, those other ones were dumb.
Although I believe Swish is what the symbol is known as.
Is it?
I believe so.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think that's what they've dubbed it.
So they just took the word for not using the backboard and just sinking the ball right in. That's because that's a swish, right?
I believe. Well, yes, that for sure. But yeah. The thing I remember hearing.
Okay, all right.
Before it was Domino's. Customers ordering.
Oh,
you should know this one. We talked about it recently.
Yeah.
Before it was known as Domino's, customers ordering pizza at the franchise's first location in 1960 had to ring up a place called Dom's Pizza, Poker Pizza, Two Brothers Pizza, or Dominick's.
Dominick's.
That is correct.
Yes, that's only because we talked about that before. All right, how many are left?
This is the last one.
Last one. Here we go. I've got, how many do I have total? Three.
Three, I believe.
Okay, three. Boy, that's fantastic.
The home of Batman and Superman didn't become officially known as DC Comics until 1977. The publisher began printing comics in 1934 under the name World's Finest Comics, National Allied Publications, National Periodic Publications, or All Fun Comics.
National Allied.
And, oh, that is correct.
I knew that. I don't know why. Wow, I got 4 out of 14. I'm a genius. All right. Dan, Kevin Powell tomorrow, right? Talking sports? All right, Kevin Powell's going to join us tomorrow talking sports. And the news is coming up right after this.